Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
I can give you an example. I was in a grocery store one time, and this black lady was talking. She may have been in her 50s talking to this white lady. And I was just happening to be, you know, over here, and I was listening to what she was saying. And she was basically talking about those bad kids coming from the city. You know, the black lady was talking about the bad kids coming from the city and how, you know, they not raised right and they, you know, blah, blah, blah. On and on, stereotyping these poor, you know, stereotyping black kids to this white woman. And I probably shouldn't have done that. And so I did inject myself into the conversation. And I asked her, you know, I said, well, you know, you're comparing a school system that's based on real estate taxes deliberately so that the black schools are inferior. So, of course, the black children are going to have an inferior education and not going to be prepared to come into your school system. And so the white lady, when I started talking about the way the taxes, you know, like, I don't know if it's that way in your state, but in our state, the property taxes supposedly fund the school, the quality of the schools. So if you come from a more affluent area, of course your property taxes are higher, i.e. your school system will be superior. So they deliberately fund it that way, and that's what I was telling her. When I said that, the white lady got this look on her face like, I don't want to be part of this conversation anymore, and she walked away. So I told the black lady, who was a little bit old, who was, you know, somewhat older than me, and I said, don't you understand that when you put black people down when you're talking to a white person, that when you walk away, you're in that same boat. You haven't extricated yourself from that. You actually, they don't look at you and think, well, that's a good black person. You know, you're basically condemning yourself. And she, you know, she, surprisingly, she didn't get real mad at me or anything because I really was out of order. But she said, oh, no, when they see Miss So-and-so, they don't think that way of me. So I don't know whether or not anything I said made any difference to her, but it's this whole idea of trying to separate ourselves. You know, I'm a better class of black. I'm a better black person, you know. And so this white, I've seen black people do it constantly, and I've done it myself, is say the things that you think will make white people take you out of the category of inferior blackness. But little do you know, white people aren't that stupid. They know that's what you're doing. They like you to do it. This is my opinion. They like you to do it because it reassures them that you are still holding them as the standard. So you're not even thinking about white supremacy overturning it, overthrowing it. You're actually participating in it and supporting it and endorsing it. So they like to see you do that, but they're well aware of what you're doing. You know, so, and they're not taking you out that category, even if they tell you something like, you know, why can't more black people be like you? They haven't taken you out that category because if they saw you as a full human being, you would not be in that stereotyped conversation. In other words, it wouldn't even occur to them to say that to you any more than they would say it to a white person. They wouldn't have a conversation with a white person and say, why can't more white people be like you? You know, so right then and there, when they make these statements to you, you know that you're being stereotyped, that you're already in that black boat. So I guess the whole thing that I would say about it is that It's very easy to fall into that trap of trying to separate yourself from the inferior black masses. But what the only thing that does really is teach you to secretly have more contempt for yourself, because there's no way that you can separate yourself from the black masses. Education won't do it. Professor Gates found that out with his Harvard degree and teaching at Harvard. He was still treated like an ordinary you-know-what when the deal went down and that white policeman decided he wanted to have a little fun. He wasn't the professor from Harvard anymore. He wasn't the professor who used to be married to a white woman. He wasn't the professor with all the degrees and all the accolades. He was just another black man. So it doesn't matter if you decide you're going to separate yourself. You're not going to be allowed to separate yourself. Whenever it's that time to remind you of what you are, they will gladly and willingly do it. So it's just a very, very psychologically dangerous position to be in. I'll just end on that. To try to separate yourself and create a false reality. It's very, very psychologically dangerous.
Context of white supremacy. Gusty Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Friday, September 28th, 2018. So I have been told this is our fifth study session on Pamela Evans Harris. Her second publication, Black Love is a Revolutionary Act. We are picking up on chapter 30 in the text, moving right along. The audio segment that we heard at the beginning of the program, a few months, February 2011 to be specifically, before this book was published, Pam the Great was on this program. She and I played the audio for an entire episode of Good Times and used that as an illustration to talk about her book, Views on Racism, White Supremacy, How Anti-Blackness is Incorporated into All Aspects of White Supremacy, Entertainment specifically. But just, I had forgotten about that, but really extraordinary broadcast. Plus, apparently, a lot of Cal's listeners have seen Sanford and Son. I think I might have said Good Time, but it was Sanford and Son. Whole episode of Sanford and Son. Amazing. Shout to the late Red Fox. Amazing. You can go back and check it out. Pam shared a lot of just fascinating points as usual, but that is where that audio segment came from, February 2011. Without further ado, we will proceed. Black Love is a Revolutionary Act, Context of White Supremacy, audio segment number one.
Chapter 30, Legend of the Purple People. In a distant place and time on planet Earth, there were two races of people in a tiny country called Purple Land. The purple people had bright purple skin, purple eyes, green lips, and thick green rope hair. The white minority in Purple Land had white skin, blonde hair, and blue eyes. The purple people owned and controlled all the banks and the money, the schools and universities, the businesses, the criminal justice system, and the government. Despite being in a supremely superior position, the purple people never missed an opportunity to tell the white people how inferior white people were. The purple people even had white statues on their lawns with exaggerated white features, like bulging blue eyes and thin lips that stretched from ear to ear. The purple people claimed the white people were too stupid to learn, but just to make sure they stayed stupid, the purple people created a separate and unequal school system that was inferior to the purple schools. The white schools were in horrible condition, with leaking roofs, lead paint, broken desks, and the outdated school books discarded by the better-educated purple children. The teachers who couldn't cut it in the purple schools were sent to the white schools, where no one would know the difference. Since the purple people had a superior education, naturally they got most of good jobs, while the white people took the menial or had no jobs at all. It was a depressing sight to travel through the white neighborhoods. The sidewalks were cracked, the city street sweepers skipped weekly cleanings, and the street lamps stayed broken. On every third corner, there were liquor stores that stayed open 24 hours a day, some within blocks of white grammar schools. Young white males openly sold crack, heroin, and reefer on the street corners, but the police seemed oblivious to their criminal activity. In the morning, the commuter trains from the purple suburbs would pass through the white neighborhoods. The purple people on the train would shake their heads and say it didn't make sense for people to live like animals. Of course, purple people never said it when white people were around. The white women were horrible and overweight from eating cheap junk food since fresh fruits and vegetables were too expensive. The men were worse, always standing on street corners and drinking out of paper bags and blaming the purple man for all of their problems. Even the movies and television were depressing because white people were always playing fools or criminals. White people never saw white people kissing, hugging, or making love on TV. Secretly, some white people believed that love and romance were reserved for purple people. Some white people resented the purple people only images and started a white civil rights organization to fight purple racism. Some complained to their church leaders and were told to stay on their knees, pray, and to stop worrying about this life because they would be rewarded in the next one. This confused the white people because no one told purple people who read the same Bible to stay on their knees. After a while, the white people were too confused and demoralized to fight the powers that be. They figured if they couldn't beat the purple people, maybe they better join them. They hung framed pictures of their savior, a purple man with green hair, on their living room walls. They didn't understand why so many young white people were turning their backs on religion and on the purple man. If only, the white parents lamented aloud, they hadn't been born with such ugly white skin, blonde hair, and blue eyes, their lives and their children's lives would have been much easier. White women began using green dye on their blonde hair so they would look more purple and less white. They bought makeup that would turn their pale pink skin a deep purple and green lipstick to wear on their lips. They wore purple contacts to hide their blue eyes, then swore they weren't wearing anything. Upon seeing the white people strutting proudly in their new get-ups, the purple people would chuckle, shake their heads, and say under their breath, "Isn't it sad to be white? No matter how hard they try, they'll never be as good as purple people." The white women suffered the most because white men thought purple women were the absolute sex bomb. The purple women loved to sneak into the white community to get some of that big white you-know-what that the white men were more than happy to give to them. The white man's self-esteem was so battered and bruised, he didn't much feel like a man, so he decided the easiest and safest way to be equal to the purple man was to find any purple woman who would have him, so he could be less white and be more acceptable, more purple. Unfortunately, the ones who suffered the most were the white women who had to pick up the pieces and raise their children alone, while the demoralized and frightened white man sought validation in a pair of purple arms. The poor white woman hid her hurt and bewilderment behind a wall of hostility because she was too proud to admit her own men thought she was inferior. The white woman didn't know what to do or where to turn. They had tried to look as purple as they could, but the white men wanted the real thing. More and more white women turned to religion. They prayed every night to the framed picture of the purple savior above their empty beds and asked him to wake the white man up and tell him to come home where he belonged. The end. When you teach a man to hate his lips, the lips that God gave him, the shape of the nose that God gave him, the texture of the hair that God gave him, the color of the skin that God gave him, you've committed the worst crime that a race of people can commit. Malcolm X. Recipe number 10, degrade the black female syndrome. A 1991 survey commissioned by the American Association of University Women discovered that little girls lose their self-esteem by adolescence. The study also found that black girls were still self-confident in high school compared to white and Hispanic girls. Researchers concluded that black parents may be teaching their children that there was nothing wrong with them, only with the way the world treated them. This should encourage white people to look with admiration at the black community, said Dr. Linda Kerber, a history professor at the University of Iowa. After the study that claimed black girls had higher self-esteem than white girls, the mainstream media launched a full-on assault on the black female image. A coincidence or by design? Chapter 31, Six Reasons Black Females Are Degraded in a White Supremacy Society. Why are black females degraded in America? Reason number one, misogyny, hatred of women. Despite Sigmund Freud's claims of female penis envy, it is more common for men in a sexist, male-dominated society to envy women. Men who seek absolute power over the lives of others often envy and fear women for their genetic power, the ability to create life, something no man, regardless of wealth or status, can do. Men who harbor secret homosexual urges may envy and resent women for the freedom to have sex with men without fear of exposure or disgrace. It is interesting that the word misogyny is derived from ancient Greek word misogynia, a culture where male homosexuality was common. If the female is envied for her sexual normalcy and her genetic power, then the black female, the most fertile female on earth, who can create life under the most adverse conditions, starvation, famine, disease, must logically speaking be the most envied of all females. This may explain one reason the black female is viciously targeted and degraded in a white male-dominated society that is founded on misogyny, sexism, racism, white supremacy, and closet male homosexuality. Her superior genetics contradict the lie of white supremacy as the creator of all authentically black life in a black-hating, white supremacy global system. She will be attacked without mercy until she is medically, sexually, biologically, psychologically, and spiritually destroyed. Reason number two, to disguise the truth about the mass rape of African female slaves. To retain a sense of their imaginary moral and racial superiority, white slave owners projected the blame for their own horrific crimes by transforming the African female slave from a victim into an immoral and sexually loose villain. This false image of the black female persists to this day. A short history of rape in America. Prior to 1972, rape was a capital crime that was punishable by death. More than 90% of the executions for rape involved black males who had allegedly raped a white female, but statistics show the vast majority of rapes in the U.S. involve white males raping black and white females. About 5% of executions for rape involved a black male who had allegedly raped a black female, and approximately 2% of executions for rape involved a white male who had allegedly raped a white female. A white male has never been executed for raping a black female because raping black females was not a crime. Was it the evidence or the system of white supremacy? 1987, Tawana Bradley, a 15-year-old black female, accused six white men, some police officers, of raping her. After missing for 4 days, she was found unresponsive in a garbage bag near an apartment where she had once resided. Her clothing was burned and her body had been smeared with feces. After hearing the evidence, a grand jury ruled that Bradley had not been the victim of a sexual assault and that she had lied. It was later rumored that one of the accused men had committed suicide after the story became public. The authors were unable to confirm this. Tawana Bradley, her parents, and supporters still maintain to this day that she told the truth. Alton H. Maddox Jr., Bradley's black lawyer, lost his law license indefinitely due to his conduct in the Bradley case, an unusual and excessively harsh decision against a criminal lawyer for defending his client. 2006, Crystal Mangum, 27, a black female student at North Carolina Central University, accused three white Duke University students, members of the Duke Blue Devils men's lacrosse team, of raping her at a party held where she had been hired as an exotic dancer. Prosecutor Mike Nifong mounted a vigorous case against the white males from prominent families after the case made national headlines. The defense attorneys for the white male students reported that a private DNA lab had found DNA from multiple males in Mangum's body, but allegedly none that belonged to the accused players. Based on further investigation, the rape charges were dropped. Nifong was disbarred, making Nifong the first prosecutor in North Carolina history to lose his law license for prosecuting a case. 2007, Megan Williams, 23, held captive for a week by six white males and females who allegedly raped and stabbed her and forced her to eat animal feces. 2 years later, after a series of encounters with law enforcement, she, Williams, recanted her story despite credible evidence and photos taken at the time that indicated she had been severely injured and traumatized, as claimed. Did Williams tell a bold-faced lie? Or was this poor young black female pressured by the legal system to recant her story? Unfortunately, we will never know the truth. The black female, aka the willing whore. If the black female is a willing whore by nature, every sexual encounter she has must be voluntary because a willing whore cannot be raped. If a willing whore cannot be raped, then it is impossible for a white male to rape a black female, whether during slavery or even in the 21st century. There is one indisputable fact. Blacks do not control the criminal justice process, the evidence collectors, the DNA labs, the prosecutors, the criminal court judges, the way the law is interpreted, or the way the media defines who is a victim and who is not. Nor do blacks control the hidden hands that mete out the usual kind of American justice that awaits most black defendants and black victims in a white supremacist criminal just us justice system. Based on the historical evidence, we can logically draw the following conclusion. If evidence can be falsified by police and district attorneys to convict black defendants, it is logical to assume that evidence can be falsified to acquit white defendants. Any black female, criminal lawyer, or prosecutor who dares to accuse a white male in a white supremacy society, especially a white male authority figure or a white male from a prominent white family, of raping her will face the full wrath of the law. These highly publicized false rape allegations demonstrate that black female rape victims will never receive the kind of media attention or public support or empathy that white female rape victims regularly receive from the police, the courts, the media, and from society in general. Black females are more likely to be raped than any other group in the U.S., but are less likely to be believed or have their victimizers caught and convicted. Why? Because ignoring, covering up, and blaming black female rape victims is an American tradition. Axiom number 6, the black victim equals a victimless crime theory. A black person in a conflict with a white person or white system cannot be the victim in a white supremacy society. The black individual is always at fault, regardless of who initiated the conflict or what facts or evidence are presented. It is critical that the soiled sexual reputation of the black female is preserved at all costs to reinforce the myth lie that female slaves were willing whores, not rape victims, of the most notorious rapists in the history of the known world. How many black females have been raped by white males but are afraid to report the crimes and risk the same fate of a Tawana Bradley or a Megan Williams? Unfortunately, we will never know the answer to that question. Is there a mass media conspiracy against black females? On August 9, 2006, the MTV network broadcast a new cartoon portraying two bikini-wearing black women squatting on all fours with leashes around their necks and defecating using the bathroom on the floor. Supposedly, the show was lampooning Snoop Dogg, who had no involvement in the show. The show aired at 12:30 p.m. on Saturday when thousands of children, teens, and young adults were watching. The cable TV station, owned by Viacom, Inc., a media giant, defended the episode, calling it social satire. Would MTV have created a cartoon showing two bikini-clad white females defecating on the floor with leashes around their neck held by a Snoop Dogg lookalike? The answer should be obvious. Reason number 3, to promote white female superiority and black female inferiority via the entertainment industry. Is there a mass media conspiracy against the black female? This question was recently asked in an article on a popular black website, and with good reason. The mounting evidence presented here should leave no doubt that someone is waging open warfare against the black female. Popular TV shows aimed at black youth. Talk shows. An almost daily lineup of poor, promiscuous black female baby mamas who don't know who the baby daddy is. The darker the female, the more degraded she will be on the show. Rap songs and rap videos. Songs about insulting, degrading, torturing, and killing black females. Young and beautiful black females are stereotyped as booty-shaking, scantily dressed video hoes to neutralize the beauty and humanity of young, beautiful black females. I call women bitches and hoes because all the women I've met since I've been out here are bitches and hoes. Bushwick Bill, Richard Shaw, a member of the hip-hop group Ghetto Boys, when asked at the National Association of Black Journalists Convention what he calls his mother, he replied, "I call her a woman, but I am not fucking my mother. If I was fucking you, you'd be a bitch." Black reality shows. Whenever black males are looking for love on reality TV, the white female is almost always chosen over the black female. Even when competing for a black male's love, the black female is almost always the least desirable, inferior choice. In reality, these reality shows are scripted by white writers, directors, and producers, regardless of any black figurehead who appears on the rolling credits as executive producer. Once the cameras are turned off, the loving interracial reality show couple go their separate ways with paychecks in hand. In contrast, in white reality shows, the white contestants always choose a white person, and the sole black contestant is usually eliminated by the first or second episode. TV commercials. The dark-skinned black female has become an endangered species in most TV commercials, replaced by the racially ambiguous non-white female with a white parent, a so-called biracial female. According to one black mother of a child actor, white female casting directors prefer to cast the non-white children of white females over the brown and dark-skinned children of black men and women in television commercials and print advertising. Some black actors have to almost threaten to quit a show or movie in order to get a black actress cast as their love interest. Eric LaSalle, Russell Thornsby, etc. Otherwise, white women are usually the first and only choice by white men who really hate black men but envy the alleged sexual prowess of black men. Although Latinas are the second choice many times, white men and white women prefer to see white women with black men. I think they hate the fact that they enjoy watching black men and white women together and exact revenge against black men because of this sexual fetish. Unless they have a little bit of clout, a black writer-producer takes a risk to suggest casting a black actress darker than Halle Berry who isn't Gabrielle Union or Sanaa Lathan. I'm relaying on what I know to be true from my own personal experiences. LR, television writer, name withheld by request. Black females on TV 50 years after Amos and Andy. NBC's ER, 1994 to 2009, a medical drama where black actor Eric LaSalle and his white female co-star Elizabeth Corday engage in an on-again, off-again interracial romance. LaSalle's was uncomfortable with his character's affair with a white woman and felt it was an insult to black women because his character had unsuccessful relationships with black women in the past. LaSalle requested that the show's writers end the affair because it sends a message I'm not comfortable with, a message that this relationship could be a happy one. Ally McBeal, 1997 to 2002. A comedy drama featuring a single white female lawyer in an all-white law firm. Ally's best friend, a single black female, could not get or keep a man. To add insult to injury, the first black actor cast in a recurring role on the show only had eyes for white Ally McBeal, who eventually dumped him. Desperate Housewives, 2004 to present. A comedy drama focused around the lives of several white females and their love lives. The first black female cast member, actress Alfre Woodard, portrayed an older, dark-skinned, overweight female wearing an unkempt, multicolored wig. Of course, she was manless, except for the man she kept chained in her basement. HBO Sopranos TV series, 1999 to 2007. A drama about Italian mobsters cast the following handful of black actresses during its 8-season run. A dark-skinned homeless female who defecates on a public sidewalk, then wipes her brown behind with a piece of newspaper. A dark-skinned toothless prostitute who sexually propositions Tony Soprano's demented elderly uncle. An overweight, dark-skinned female who gets into an argument with Tony Soprano's sister during an anger management session. An attractive, light-skinned, undercover FBI agent, a potential white man's whore, who flirts with Tony Soprano at a doctor's office. A prostitute, a white man's whore, in a Jewish-owned whorehouse who boasts she can make the Hasidic Jew's Benny penis spin. the dark-skinned girlfriend of Tony Soprano's elderly Jewish friend, who was never seen with her in public. She dies in his bed without a wedding ring, any fanfare, or even a funeral on a television series obsessed with funerals. A typically bad ending for a white man's whore. Grey's Anatomy, 2005 to present, a medical drama featuring a passionate interracial relationship between black actor Isaiah Washington and Asian actress Sandra Oh. It is very revealing, an anti-black female, that the most virile black male on the show is paired with a non-black female. 1899 sheet music cover published by Saks Music Company, Boston. I'm calling you ugly. I could push your face in some dough and make gorilla cookies. Fred Stanford, speaking to Aunt Esther, a dark-skinned black female, from the hit TV series Sanford and Son, 1971 to 1977. The top seven roles for black actresses in Hollywood movies, with a few exceptions. The light-skinned or non-white female with a white parent who lusts after white men, a.k.a. the white man's whore. The provocative mulatto wench stereotype is a carryover from the early 1900s minstrel shows. Some examples of the tragic mulatto white man's whore are black actresses Lisa Bonet in Angel Heart and Halle Berry in Monster Ball. The long-haired, light-skinned, and or so-called biracial black female who plays the love interest of the main black male character, if he is not romantically involved with a non-black female. The brown or dark-skinned, hostile, immoral, tough, ghetto, black female who can't get or keep a man. The brown or dark-skinned monster mother. The brown or dark-skinned female prostitute. The dark-skinned, obese, single, and desperate black female, mammy figure, or demonic character. A black actress who does not fit any of the above six categories automatically defaults to the largest category of black actresses, the unemployed. It is the norm to see one black actor in a commercial, TV show, or a movie without a single black actress in sight. The defective, undesirable black female theme. District 9, 2009, science fiction movie portraying dark-skinned Nigerian women as savage cannibal prostitutes who have sex with insect aliens. Hollywood Wives, The New Generation, 2003, made-for-TV movie. Robin Givens plays the single black female friend of romantically involved white females. True to Hollywood's racist form, Givens was the only female who did not have a man, a.k.a. the defective, unlovable black female. Lord of War, 2005, an arms dealer, Nicolas Cage, is propositioned by two beautiful dark-skinned African prostitutes, but finds out that both women are HIV-infected. By linking the sexually attractive black female with immorality, low character, and disease, this effectively neutralizes the beauty of the black female, a necessity in a system of white supremacy. Norbit, 2007, Big Mama's House 1 and 2, 2000 to 2006, and Tyler Perry's Madea comedies revolve around black males wearing wigs, dresses, and pantyhose to portray dark skin, obese, crude, violent, and romantically undesirable black females. To the author's knowledge, there are no white actors who have built an entire movie career stereotyping obese white females by wearing dresses, wigs, and stockings. In fact, it is rare to see an obese white female in a Hollywood film or TV show, despite the significant number of real-life obese white females in America. Reason number four, to humiliate and demoralize black females. The most infamous example of public black female degradation occurred on April 7, 2007, when shock jock Don Imus called the black females on the Rutgers University basketball team nappy-headed hoes. In a previous lesser-known incident, Don Imus attacked Gwen Ifill, the black female moderator of the highly acclaimed television political news show Washington Week. Isn't the Times wonderful? It lets the cleaning lady cover the White House. The XM shock jocks Opie and Anthony joked about an unidentified homeless man raping the first black female Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice. I just imagine the horror on Condoleezza Rice's face as you were just like holding her down and fucking her. Even the 7.0 magnitude earthquake in Haiti in 2010, where 200,000 people were feared dead, was seen as a golden opportunity for Florida shock jock Buddha the Love Sponge to take a nasty shot at black women. I would have to say that Haitian hookers are probably infected with a whole bunch of stuff. You might have to. You know what? Maybe this is actually a good thing. A lot of talk shows appeal to the angry white guy. The shock jock gives voices to the really ugly thoughts. Minorities have gotten too much. I'm not doing as well as I used to. Jane Hall, an assistant professor in American University School of Communication. Black male entertainers and white supremacy. Black male entertainers are often rewarded by the white supremacy system for participating in the public degradation of black females. Now, they aren't hoes, but there were some nappy-headed women on that team. Those are some of the ugliest women I've ever seen in my whole life. D.L. Hughley on Jay Leno's Tonight Show, May 7, 2007, joking about the black girls on the Rutgers University basketball team. 6 months after his comment on The Tonight Show, D.L. Hughley hosted the 13th Annual Critics' Choice Awards on VH1, November 2007, the 39th Annual NAACP Image Awards, February 2008, the BET Awards, June 2008. A short-lived CNN comedy news show, D.L. Hughley Breaks the News, October 2008, which features chitlin' jokes during the presidential election campaign of Barack Obama. Shortly after the election ended, so did the show. What could be more demoralizing for a group of women than being publicly degraded before the entire world by the same men they gave birth to? Apparently, the magic elixir for reviving a stagnant career is degrading black females. 6 months after fellow comic D.L. Hughley hit the entertainer payload, actor-comedian Damon Wayans appeared on the daytime talk show The View. Freedom of speech, what happened to that? What happened to expressing yourself? At least I know where he stands. And you know what? When he called them nappy-headed hoes, I went, wow, he's right. Black people at home are laughing right now. Damon Wayans on the Don Imus controversy on The View TV show, November 2007. As of this writing, Wayans hasn't hosted any CNN talk shows or star-studded awards show. However, he is planning to write a book. What a shame. Reason number 5, to demonize the black mother figure, the womb that produces all authentically black life. Black monster mothers. Losing Isaiah, 1995. A black baby boy abandoned by his black crack-addicted mother, Halle Berry, is adopted by a caring white female social worker and her husband. Once the baby's mother finds out her son is not dead, like she was told, she goes to court to get him back. The Day the Earth Stood Still, 2008. A remake of the science fiction classic, white female scientist Jennifer Connelly risks life and limb to save Earth and still finds time to raise her black stepson from a previous marriage to a conveniently deceased black husband. The black birth mother is never mentioned, and at the end of the movie, the black boy calls the white female Mama. Precious, 2009. An obese, dark-skinned black female, Gabourey Sidibe, is tortured by a horribly cruel, sexually perverted, evil black mother, Monique, her rapist black father, and a random assortment of good, mulatto blacks and bad, dark-skinned blacks. The Blind Side, 2009. A caring white female, Sandra Bullock, rescues a homeless black boy, taking another shot at defective black mothers. To the author's knowledge, no movie has been made about white children of a defective white mother who are rescued by a black female. Thanks to white Hollywood and their well-paid black puppets, black mothers have become synonymous with crackheads, welfare cheats, and sexual degenerates, a not-so-different image found in early white American society. They are the greatest menace possible to the moral life of any community where they live. And they are evidently the chief instruments of the degradation of the men of their own race. When a man's mother, wife, and daughters are all immoral women, there is no room in his fallen nature for the aspirations of honor and virtue. I cannot imagine such a creation as a virtuous black woman. From a 1904 pamphlet, Experiences of the Race Problem, by a Southern white woman. Black females, the victims of mass rape by white males, were labeled immoral by a moral white female who blamed them for being raped. What happened to the black mother mammy images that nurtured black and white America? And what are the long-term consequences for black boys who are being programmed to see white females as the most loving mother figures for black boys? The double oppression of black women in America. That man over there say that women needs to be lifted over ditches and to have the best place everywhere. Nobody ever helped me into carriages or over mud puddles or gives me any best place. And aren't I a woman? Look at me. Look at my arm. I have plowed and planted and gathered into barns and no man could head me. And aren't I a woman? I could work as much and eat as much as a man when I could get it and bear the lash as well. And aren't I a woman? I have bore 13 children and seen most also off into slavery. And when I cry out with a mother's grief, none but Jesus heard. And aren't I a woman? Sojourner Truth, at the Women's Rights Convention of 1851 in Akron, Ohio, after being greeted with boos and hisses from white females. Why are American white women so anxious to adopt a dusty little heathen child from the third world? It's the latest fad of the white woman savior, and it carries high status. A white American woman must adopt a third world child, preferably a non-white, to really keep up the savior image. It's a grand American tradition dating back to the early 19th century Christian missions. Only today, you don't have to be Christian at all. You just have to be white, female, and preferably single. From American White Women Adopting Dark Foreign Children by David Yeagley. For sale, Black Babies to the Highest Bidder. The myth of the white female savior saving black babies. Some common characteristics of the white female savior. She is rich and famous and usually works in the entertainment field. She is single or divorced. She dates and marries white males exclusively. She has few to no blacks in her social or professional circle. Her preferred adoption choice is a dark-skinned black male baby. In light of the above, what is the true motivation of the white female savior? Is it a fad or competition between white celebrity rivals? Is it a desire to help a child in need? Is it a hidden desire to have a black, melanated child without the scandal and professional fallout from being impregnated by a black male? Or is it a hidden competition with the black female? It is an interesting coincidence that these trendy white female savior adoptions of black babies, usually black males, are occurring around the same time the white females are experiencing a fertility crisis and Hollywood is producing black monster mother movies for the black and white masses. Are these adoptions an attempt to replace the black female as the authentic mother figure for the next generation of black men? Or is it the increasingly infertile white female's desperate attempt to be equal to the genetically superior and highly fertile black female by taking the black female's babies and making them her own? Interracial adoptions are a one-way street. Whites are allowed to adopt black babies with ease, but it is highly unlikely that whites would approve or permit a single black female, even a rich and famous one, to adopt a white baby. Whites know their offspring are their most valuable resource and the future foot soldiers for white supremacy. They know it is not in the white collective's best interest for non-whites, their enemies, to raise and program white children who might resist the idea of maintaining the system of white supremacy. In fact, black couples usually face more hurdles than white couples when adopting black children because white institutions are still deciding the fate of black children over 140 years after slavery. Sadly, some blacks are thrilled whenever whites adopt by black babies and may be secretly relieved to be relieved of the burden of caring for our own. Buying black babies is simply an updated version of an old American slave tradition during a time when black men, women, and babies were sold to the highest white bidder. Stolen generation. Between 1910 and 1970, up to 100,000 Aboriginal children were taken forcefully or under duress from their families by police or welfare officers. Most were under 5 years old. There was rarely any judicial process. To be Aboriginal was enough. They were known as the stolen generations. Most were raised in the church or state institutions. Some were fostered or adopted by white parents. Many suffered physical and sexual abuse. Food and living conditions were poor. Most grew up in a hostile environment without family ties or cultural identity. They received little education and were expected to go into low-grade domestic and farming work. As adults, many suffered insecurity, lack of self-esteem, feelings of worthlessness, depression, suicide, violence, delinquency, abuse of alcohol and drugs, and the inability to trust. What is the true motivation behind white adoption's theft of non-white children? Imagine everything you know and love gone and you never get to see it again. Helen Morin said, I thought I hadn't been good enough. I must have done something wrong. I must be a bad person. Helen Morin was 23 months old when she was one of the thousands of Aboriginal children stolen from their parents by white Australian officials. Even though her family was extremely poor, she was loved and cared for. But a court ruled her parents unfit and her parents lost all six of their children. She never saw her parents again. Tragically, similar tales were told by other Aboriginal children, like Ava Scale, who was taken from her mother's breast when she was 7 days old, and Bob Randall, who was abducted by a strange white man on a horse at the age of 5 and never saw his family again. What was the end result of these forced adoptions by whites? The deliberate and systematic destruction of an entire non-white race. Aborigines make up about 2% of Australia's population, but they suffer disproportionately high rates of imprisonment and ill health. Source: Aboriginal Children Starving Welfare Workers Say, by Phil Mercer, BBC News, August 4, 2010. The bottom line: if the white female savior truly wanted to help black babies, she would speak out against the white racism in her own industry and refuse to star in movies that demonize black men and women, the natural parents of the same black babies she claims to love. She would use her star power to speak out against the white racism that creates black poverty and black family dysfunction, the same circumstances that make black adoptions necessary in the first place. She would use her financial muscle to support black organizations that are fighting the closure of black public schools and would join the protest lines outside police stations after a white policeman murders the full-size version of the black baby boy she so lovingly adopted. She would help fight a criminal justice system that imprisons black fathers and mothers for 5 to 10 years for having a drug addiction, and she would fight against the white imperialists who deliberately bankrupt, loot, and pillage the African nations under the banner of white supremacy, robbing poor Africans of their ability to feed their own children. If that is too big a job and too big a sacrifice, she could help the same village or community instead of looting another black family or African village of their most valuable resource, their children. For the price of a diamond bracelet or a Birkenstock handbag, the white female savior could educate and feed an entire African village for an entire year. She could help most by helping an African village take care of its own children rather than bringing that black or African child into a strange, white, hostile environment where to be black is to be abnormal and undesirable, even for blacks born in the States. The dark side of interracial adoptions. Blacks who are adopted by whites and raised in all-white communities often speak of being alienated, having an identity crisis, being extremely lonely, and even suicidal. They have been victims of racial slurs and comments, often by their own adopted family members, schoolmates, and neighbors. Understandably, they often wish they were white like their adopted family and experience difficulty in being accepted by either race. While single black mothers are demonized for raising their own black sons without a black father, the single white female savior is praised for adopting black boys who have never had a black male role model and are unlikely to have any intimate contact with blacks at all. A white female, be she rich or poor, ordinary or famous, cannot be a male or female role model for a black boy or girl. Money can buy material comforts, but cannot take the place of the kind of role model black children desperately need in a black-hating society. That is the bottom line when it comes to the so-called benefits of black children and their white female savior mothers. Reason number 6. Degrading the black female degrades all black life, male and female, and creates an inferiority complex that can last a lifetime. The long-term dangers of degrading the black female. The social position of a race is determined by the social position of the female. In every culture, the mother is sacred. She is the civilizer of her culture, community, children, and society. As the first teacher, her primary responsibility is to civilize the children by passing along the values and traditions of her culture to the next generation. The way the female sees herself will determine the way that ethnic group ultimately sees, values, and respects itself. What kind of values will today's young, degraded black mothers pass along to their already endangered children? Once the black mother, the black female, is so degraded she becomes uncivilized, she will not be able to civilize anyone else. As a result, the children, the men, the community, and the entire nation become demoralized, self-hating, self-disrespecting, and uncivilized. By creating the image of the female mother as that of a whore, the male and female child will be psychologically devastated, which partly explains the despair, anger, and hopelessness that so many black children are experiencing today. Since the black female is the creator of all authentically black life, the more damaged she is, the more likely she will bear damaged crops that will be no threat to the system of white supremacy. What is the collective response of the black males to the mass media degradation of black females? Silence. One black male's explanation: the black man is always getting dogged out. It's a relief to see someone else getting it for a change. Reggie, 38, refinery worker. The problem with that logic, Reggie, is that somebody else is your mother, sisters, and daughters. That somebody else is the mother of the next black generation and the first female role model for black children. If we do not stand up collectively as men and women and oppose the degradation of the black mothers of our black nation, we will reap the bitter harvest of more damaged black children and the eventual destruction of the black nation. No nation can rise higher than its woman. The Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad, 1897 to 1975. During a 1969 interview by Sammy Davis Jr. on the Mike Douglas Show, Sammy Davis asks Ali, "What does black power mean to you?" Ali, "Well, to me, black power means, number one, black men respecting and protecting with their lives, if necessary, their women, because we are taught by our leader that a man's woman is the field which produces his nation. If he doesn't protect his field, he'll produce a bad nation. She's the field that produces our sons and our daughters. Is not your woman more valuable than that crop of corn, that crop of cotton, that crop of cabbage, potatoes, beans, and tomatoes? How much more valuable is your woman than these crops that you should keep the enemies from destroying the crops? Yet you are not careful about your women. You don't love them. Why? Is it because you have allowed visitors to run in and out of your house? Thus they destroy your love for your woman, and your woman has not the love for you that she should? Until we learn to love and protect our woman, we will never be a fit and recognized people on the earth. The white people here among you will never recognize you until you protect your woman. The brown man will never recognize you until you protect your woman. The yellow man will never recognize you until you protect your woman. The white man will never recognize you until you protect your woman." Message to the Black Man in America by the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. A partial list of what black female signifies in a white supremacist society: mammy, defective, ugly, ghetto, mean, monster mama, crazy, violent, can't get or keep a man or find a husband, nappy-headed, weave-wearing, hoe, whore, sexually promiscuous, Jezebel, a white man's whore, illiterate, sapphire, emasculating, sexually disease-carrying, sadity, baby mama, uppity, big-lipped, white nose, gorilla face, big booty, gangsta video hoe, too evil, too educated for her own good, money-hungry, gold digger, stuck-up, materialistic, money-hungry, mannish, mentally unstable, violent, criminal, welfare-cheating, obese, fat, government-cheese-eating bitch.
Context of white supremacy. First audio segment: Black Love is a Revolutionary Act. Narrated by Red in Vegas and Medi had help with this one. If folks have questions, comments, thoughts on the first segment that we just heard, the number 641-715-3640, the code 564 #943. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. We will have additional audio to include from Pam the Great as we proceed. With that, first few folks who dialed in, if you have a hand up commentary you would like to share, a line should be open. Proceed.
Good evening, Gus.
Greetings, Thomas in New York. Good to hear from you. No headaches today,
good to
hear I hope.
You as well. No, I'm pretty good today. Just hot right now, but either way, man, this was so on point. Everything she just she laid out about the black woman and how they're treated. I mean, and these images. And since she's written this book, I think it's even gotten worse on television. With some of these reality shows, it just does a number on the psyche. I mean, you never really even think of it. Snoop Dogg with the girls with the chains around their neck, and you know, I remember when he did that. You know, and I guess I never even thought about it. You know, until she just put it there. I never really even looked at it. I just he just acted like he doing what he do to sell records or whatever, but man, that part about the she left out one thing with the Sopranos. I remember they had these young black boys and they was supposed to kill a white person, and at the last second they decided they didn't want to go through with the hit, so they had those two black boys killed. District 9, where they were sleeping with I never even thought, I never looked at it that way. So I'll let other people talk, Gus. Thank you.
Much obliged, Thomas in New York. Other folks have comments, questions, thoughts they would like to share. Line should be open. Proceed.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for allowing me to share. This is Red in Las Vegas. I definitely agree with what Thomas said. I know as I was reading it, I was thinking about all the different images, and I looked up that video, the show that she had referred to in the book, and it's definitely just as bad as it's written. And they didn't even, show what happened to the black female. They're supposed to be just following him around like dogs. And I was thinking, they're not, they were in the, position of being dogs, but not being treated, as well as at least white people tend to treat their dogs. So I definitely, like I said, I definitely agree with that. And then I watched some of the other things, she was discussing the norm bid and stuff like that, and then watch a poem, but it's really not paying attention and then seeing, yes, this is actually what is happening. One thing that I know that I noticed, and I feel like it's not just for black females, but it's for black males as well, when it comes to these crime shows, I always think it's interesting how when they have to do a recap, they won't even, really care how the black person looks. But if it's a white person in the recap, if the white woman has red hair and is tall, they'll get someone who is, actor, red hair and tall. And, and just definitely even how she was talking about kind of replacing black children replacing children who have two black parents with one black parent. Definitely, I see that a lot as well. The one thing that I did want to share, I think it was from last week, about the poem or writing Complexions by the writer of Tom Sawyer. I forgot his name.
Mark Twain.
Right. I felt like that was kind of, at least maybe like Delectable Negro type, because it seemed like how he was really describing like non-white men seemed really, at least sexualized to me, you know, really talking about their skin and how, and it was more like he was referring to the men. He did say women when he was referring to how the women, you know, they really couldn't do anything for their skin, but he didn't say black women or, you know, black girls or females or whatever. He was only referring to the men. So I thought maybe that might be secretly homosexual as well. I'll meet my line. Thank you.
Much obliged. Red in Nevada. She was referencing Mark Twain's piece of writing, Complexions. We've talked about, actually, we'll have to see if I can play that sound clip next week. We talked about that very piece on a program, Pam and I, in 2011, a few months before this book was published. I'll see if I can serve that up next Friday. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary to share, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
All right. Greetings, Gus, and greetings to all the callers and listeners. just a correction here. I think the book has Tawana Bradley. Her name is Tawana Brawley. Just as a correction there. That was also an interesting case, which which the New York State Appellate Court had barred Alton Maddox, Tawana Brawley's attorney, you know, suspended his license. I think it was like the first time in New York history where an attorney's license got suspended by the New York State Appellate Court or something like that. I was reading the Duke LaCrosse case. Also interesting about that was during the time of that case, there was a PhD student there. His name was Richard Spencer. So I kind of wonder if Mr. Spencer sharpened his white supremacist views, you know, observing that case with black females, you know, being the victims of that case. The white female savior complex that Pam describes kind of reminds me of the 19th century painting of John Gass of the American Progress. For those who don't know, it's some painting with a white woman going westward. It was supposed to symbolize America's westward view of taking the land of the non-white Native Americans and also killing them off as well. And that painting was represented by a huge white woman floating in the air. So, then, you know, that kind of reminds you of the white female savior who's been around for a long time. And also with white female adoption, I don't know if I missed it, but the one thing I did not hear Pam say, and I don't know if this is just a recent thing, but white female who adopt black boys and effeminizing them, putting them in dresses, letting them wear makeup, that type of thing. I think it's Angelina Jolie and the other woman, I forgot her name. They have black boys and they're allowing them to like wear dresses. So terrorizing them with allowing them to wear dresses and pose as girls, I guess. So that's all I have on my line.
I think it's Charlize Theron, the suspected race soldier. Area of the world known as South Africa is the other white woman who has done a lot of the, what they call, well, transracial abduction, where she has black child in her custody who is engaged in that behavior. I think that might be who he's referencing. Other folks who dialed in that we've not heard from at all, if you have commentary, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am. Greetings. I believe that's Ivy.
Yes, sir. Greetings to us and greetings to all the callers on the line. I want to say white females are more likely to be raped than black women. Black women are not the most likely to be raped. White females are raped at a rate of over 150,000 a year. For us, it's less than 50,000 a year. Women, and I would say probably black women, started the dog name calling. We started with all men are dogs. So we can't really play victim now and cry foul now about, you know, them calling us the B word. Black men's image is degraded more than anyone's because, yes, ours is, you know, being masculine and disease-ridden and fat and all these other things. But black men's image is that they are, you know, they are savages and rapists that deserve to be killed. And it's being used to justify killing you guys in the streets every day. I don't know what was said about homosexuality concerning men because my vote line went out at that time. But I'll say this. I think a real unknown thing is that most homosexuals are women, and black women are homosexuals at double the rate of black men. And it just seems like that the promotion out here is that men are mostly the homosexuals, and that isn't true. And that it's, you know, with black people that it's black men, and that's not true at all. 10% of homosexuals are black women, 5% are black men. As far as, you know, putting, you know, black men calling us bees and saying the nappy headed hoes and all these things that they say about us and all of that. Well, you know, black women have said terrible things on tape and in movies and things like that about men as well. You take Waiting to Exhale, the late great Whitney Houston, Greta Devine, Angela Bassett, and whoever else was in there was saying that black men want you to be their mothers and their fathers, that they are in jail, that they're homosexual, that they are with white women. And it was just this line of just continually running them down. We call you guys niggers, because that word is really reserved for black men, not black women per se. Of course, for white people, it's for everybody. But when you talk about that term is being referred to for black men and black women do a lot of that with you guys, as well as calling you dogs and things of that nature. I don't believe that women are doubly oppressed at all. I think that if anything, black men are doubly oppressed because they are black, and because they are men, they are the strongest in the group that is going to replace white supremacy with justice. They are the biggest threat to it. And the reason I say I don't believe women are doubly oppressed is because I don't believe sexism has that it exists. I already went through that in the past. Black men are not responsible for us not being recognized. White people are responsible for that. Black women, we are silent as well when our men are degraded. And the reason that we are silent is because we can't protect each other and we can't protect ourselves. Last two things I want to say is that women are not the only procreators. We can't do that by ourselves. So men are the procreators as well. And that our group is only as strong as our men and our women, not just our women. And I'll mute my line. Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Gus.
Much obliged, Ivy. Other folks who dialed in, if you have commentary, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir, retired firefighter.
Yes, I'm just calling to say right now that I'm not in a good spot for conversating, and believe it or not, I just left Winn-Dixie. But anyway, when I get in a comfortable spot, I'll raise some conversation. Thank you.
Much obliged. We were just talking about Winn-Dixie on the program. Wacky. Other folks who dialed in, if you have a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
Yes, may I be heard?
Mr. Demery Four, yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Greetings, Gus. Greetings to the callers and listeners. I'm in agreement with everything that has been said so far. I'll start with the legend of the Purple People, which you can just, you know, exchange the white people for black people, and you'd have a perfect scenario, you know, of what's actually going on today. The part about, she said at almost at the end, unfortunately, the ones who suffer most were the white women who had to pick up pieces and raise their children alone, while the demoralized and frightened white men saw validation in a pair of purple arms. The poor white women hid her hurt and bewilderment behind the wall of hostility because she was too proud to admit her own men thought she was inferior. And I think that that statement kind of gives us a little insight on how Pam was thinking. I remember the impact she had upon me because I didn't look at the degradation of black females as a collective until I started to listen to her speak and then read her books. And it is a, you know, it's something that we should be aware of, and especially black males should take the time to look at this particular view of just how much, you know, the degradation process has affected black females. Now, she mentioned sexist and male-dominated society, which I've heard some feedback on that. I would say a white male-dominated society, if, you know, you want to get the point across that, you know, females suffer, you know, I would say, you know, a second-rate position. But then going so far as a, you know, to draw the line between male and female, I wouldn't do that because from my experience, whites, whether you female or male, they still control everything, so they are responsible for most of the, for all of the wrongs. I thought another thing was interesting is that in one of these cases, I believe it was, yeah, the Crystal Magnum, where the Duke University students was accused of raping a girl at a party. And that was a black female. She was hired to be an exotic dancer. But the prosecutor was Mike Nafon. He was white. And then to show you the consequences, you know, of going against the code of white supremacist system, this guy was disbarred indefinitely for just prosecuting the case. So she also, you know, pointed out that because ignoring, covering up, and blaming black female rape victims for being raped is an American tradition. You know, it's interesting to find out there's no white man that has ever, you know, been convicted raping a black woman, and, you know, they're the major rapists around. And when she got into the media part and how the media is used to further denigrate black females, I mean, you can't deny some of these things. But black male entertainers are often rewarded by the white supremacist system for participating in the public denigration of black females. it does seem like that. You know, I'm not completely sold on it all together because I think about Bill Cosby, who was convicted and sentenced to go into prison. He was a celebrity, black celebrity, and it doesn't matter, you know, your position. If you're a black person in this society, you can be terrorized and mistreated, you know. So to blame one against the other, I don't think is correct. And one thing I can't say about Bill Cosby is all the other, not all the other, but a lot of the comedians were forced to wear a dress. And one thing Mr. Bill Cosby did not do was put a dress on. And last thing I'll talk about is whites allowed to adopt black babies with ease, but it's highly unlikely that whites would embrace a single black female, even a rich and famous one, of adopting a white baby. And I think that says it all right there. They allow the kidnapping of black babies, but they're not having you adopt white kids. I'll mute my line on that, Gus. Thanks for taking the call.
Much obliged, Mr. Demery, for. Just wanted to get one correction in. It's no white man has received the death penalty for raping a black female. There are white men that have been convicted for raping black females. The case of Betty Jean Owens is one, but just wanted to get that accurate. Are there any folks that we've missed completely? Grant, I will assume we nabbed everybody, at least for the time being. Do have an audio clip from Pam the Great. Before I get to the audio clip, Daryl Howard, is that name familiar to anybody? Daryl Howard of North Carolina, since that might be a common name. Daryl Howard, anyone? Anyone? I'll assume that is no. No one's familiar with Daryl Howard. Okay. That case with Crystal Mangum, black female, the Duke lacrosse team, this happened in the like mid-2000s. And the attorney, Michael Nifong, was disbarred in this case because he withheld exculpatory evidence, as they call it. In the case, and he lied during the case. He lied during the case. Master deceivers, whites are. And Pam asserts in the text that he was disbarred because he had the audacity to bring this case against these white Duke lacrosse players, which could be true. We are in a system of racism, white supremacy. I asked on the program because there is a lot of info on this case, and I said, ESPN 30 for 30. I said, they've done a lot of documentaries. They did a documentary on this case. And I asked, did anybody see that documentary? Again, crickets. Nobody had seen it. I said, oh, man, you all should see that documentary. It is fascinating. They have people that have written books about it. Like, you should probably take a gander at this case. In my view, Mr. Nifong should have been disbarred. Now, it may have been. Yeah, he should have been disbarred. And it was also, you know, we felt like he was going against the system of racism, white supremacy in prosecuting this case. But what he did in this case, again, he withheld exculpatory evidence. That is evidence that would tend to exonerate the person that is being charged with a crime. That was the white Duke lacrosse players in this case. And Gusty is certainly not saying that they were innocent. That being saying, I'm just saying that you have one group of white evildoers, the Duke lacrosse players, and then you have another white evildoer, Michael Nifong. With Mr. Nifong, he withheld exculpatory evidence and then he lied on the stand. The Washington Post has done several reports, as have many other outlets. There's a lot of, you know, information about most Mr. Nifong and Crystal Mangum, who was later convicted of murder. That's a whole nother topic, which we talked about on the program before. The Washington Post, they have an article, this is from 2014, about Daryl Howard. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but it reads, "Perhaps most interesting of all is just who the prosecutor was of the Daryl Howard case. This is a black male who was prosecuted of a double murder and arson in the 1990s in North Carolina. He has maintained his innocence for more than 25 years at this point. Anyway, Mr. Nifong was the prosecutor then. He was then assistant district attorney for Durham County. Nifong, of course, would later be appointed then elected district attorney and then make national headlines in 2006 when he falsely charged three Duke University lacrosse players with sexually assaulting a stripper. In 2007, Nifong was disbarred for handling of evidence in that case. He was also found in contempt for making false statements about the case in court. But Howard's incarceration spans a period of time over which several scandals have raised questions about dispensation of justice in Durham County. In 2010, a report commissioned by the North Carolina Attorney General, which followed a prior investigation by Raleigh News and Observer, uncovered widespread corruption and malfeasance in the state's crime lab, including in many cases from Durham County. Fallout from the scandal contributed to the removal of Nifong's successor, District Attorney Tracy Klein, in 2012. Prosecutors are rarely ever removed from office for misconduct. They had back-to-back prosecutors removed from office. For it to happen twice in the same county within 5 years is extraordinary. The Washington Post was unable to reach Mike Nifong or Tracy Klein. The office of interim Durham District Attorney Leon Stanback did not respond to several requests for comment. But missing from all those scandals was any effort to assess the breadth and scope of their reach. Even after Nifong and Klein were removed from office, public officials in Durham County showed little interest in an audit or investigation into the damage they may have done. Part of that may be due to Durham County's politics and the lingering legacy of the Duke case. With its mix of academic progressives and working class blacks, Durham is arguably the most left of center county in the state, whatever that means. In the 2012 presidential election, Obama received 76% of the vote in Durham County, his best showing in the state. The lacrosse case, of course, featured several well-to-do white men accused of raping a low-income black female. That set the stage for an unlikely lineup of adversaries, as progressive groups, academics, feminists, and racial justice advocates sided with the overzealous prosecutor, while the political right lined up behind the accused. But prosecutorial misconduct is rarely a one-off phenomenon. If it has happened once with a prosecutor or within a particular office, it has probably happened before. And in Durham County, this is the most important, or in my view, maybe one of the most important parts of the report. In Durham County, a county that's 40% black, 7.5% Latino, put that in quotes, the victims in those other cases are far more likely to be people like Daryl Howard, black male, than wealthy white students on a college lacrosse team. I think Mr. Nifong was probably practicing racism, white supremacy in that county and locking up a lot of black males like Mr. Daryl Howard. And it just happened for whatever reason. It could have been, oh, yeah, I'll take this case and, you know, I'll get some notoriety. That's what they even allege in that documentary, the ESPN one, that, oh, yeah, I'll take this case and it'll get me some notoriety and I'll bust these guys and do what I've normally been doing to niggers in this state all along. And in fact, one of the suspected racist, formerly accused Duke lacrosse players, he says at the end, you know, I'm well-to-do. Got a lot of money. My parents are well off. White. I don't think he said that explicitly, but certainly white. They had the resources to dig in and get a private investigator and gun to cover what he was doing. Like, my gosh, I can't even imagine if I was Daryl Howard. He didn't say his name, but my gosh, if I had been Daryl Howard, whew, we could have been like in jail. you should check it out. I do not agree with the assessment. Make it plain. I do not agree that Mr. Nifong, he should have been disbarred. And I do not think people have followed that case through its entirety to get more information about what happened, what he may have been doing before the Crystal Mangum case even came onto the radar in 2006. But I would encourage people to read, post that report, watch that ESPN documentary. It is worth checking out. I'm sure they practice racism there as well, but check that out because it seemed the last time I asked, a lot of people hadn't heard of it. Now, I did say we had a sound clip from Pam. Did anybody have a comment on that one? Anybody? Gus talking crazy? Comment? Grant.
I had a separate comment.
Comment.
Crystal Mangum related.
It was about the whole white males being convicted. I just had a question about that, so technically no.
Okay.
I'll save it.
Much obliged. Much obliged. Does anybody have a Crystal Mangum related comment, or Mr. Nifong? I guess I should link them. All righty.
I was going to say, you don't sound crazy to me. I need more.
Grant, I would encourage folks to do more research around that. And again, it's not that I think Mr. Nifong was not practicing racism. Absolutely. I think he had been doing it for a long, long time, and he was just trying to do the regular tricks he had been doing all along with these young white suspected race soldiers, and they had the resources to uncover, like, oh man, this dude. And it wasn't even like, oh man, widespread. It was just, oh, he mistreated us in this one case, not, whoa, he's probably been doing this the whole time he's been in office. Like, man, we should be reviewing and letting people like Daryl Howard out of prison. In fact, Daryl Howard, people should research Daryl Howard before anybody says anything about Mr. Nifong and whether he should have been disbarred or not. Who is Daryl Howard? That would be homework. Who is Daryl Howard, North Carolina? Research that case and why he is in greater confinement. That said, I know Red said she had commentary. We will get that and anybody else who has commentary, but we will hear directly from Pam before we get everybody else's voices, thoughts, or questions. This is Pam the Great giving her commentary on Sanford and Son, which is a hoot because it was mentioned, the Gorilla Cookie segment, which Red narrated for us. She's talking about Sanford and Son. We did a whole episode, as I mentioned in the intro, a whole episode in February 2011 on Sanford and Son. We would just kind of play a segment, pause, and then Pam would give her commentary on how this, you know, relates to her views. But wow, this is one of the segments, and she even talks about the forthcoming book. This program was about two or three months before Black Love as a Revolutionary Act was published. But this is Pam the Great, Context of White Supremacy, February, Black History Month, 2011.
Yeah, I got the same impression you did. They played it off so noble that the reason he did not support his blood, his own race of women, or a woman from his own race, was turned into something noble. You know, so again, you know, I mean, the references, calling the King Kong, the way that they talk to each other, it's classic textbook for the way that black males and females have been taught to relate to each other. And I'm not saying that that's the way we all do it, but there's a lot of that underlying our relationships in general, whether they're romantic relationships, whether they're work relationships, whether they're just two people passing in the street who don't know each other. It almost seems normal for black men and black women to be in conflict mode. And they'll never show us in cooperation mode. If you've noticed that, they never show black men and women solving a problem together. In the second book, we talk about how it seems like there's only two types of movies that white Hollywood is willing to embrace. And one has to be, you know, so-called movies that involve black males and black females and their relationships. Either the good black female has to overcome the evil black male, or the good black male has to triumph without the help of the black female. So when you looked at this movie, I forget the name of it, where some black man was poor and he worked his way up, and he lived on the street, and he had his child by, you know, he was raising his child by himself, you know.
Pursuit of Happiness.
I think so, uh-huh. So it's like if the black male is a good black male, he's going to do whatever he has to do without the help or assistance of black women. That's just a given. If it's a black woman who's a good black person, she's trying to accomplish or succeed at something as opposed to the black male being a hindrance and being an obstacle. So, you know, this Sanford and stuff, you know, they pretty much started it pretty early. But if you look at most of the black shows, unless they're comedy, and they're just buffoonery anyway, unless they're a sitcom, if black men and women are interacting seriously, it's always going to be about conflict. I remember, you remember this show, Frank's Place? Tim Reed came on, God, maybe 20 years ago?
The name
sounds.
It was
New Orleans. It was in New Orleans, and it had, it seems like, you know, every blue moon you might see a black show, sitcom, whatever, where the black people were humanized. And Frank's Place was one of those sitcoms where the black people were actually humanized. Well, it didn't stay on that long, so, you know, that's pretty much why. So this is just psychological warfare. And at some point, all warfare has a military agenda. And Dr. Frances Claus-Wellsley, she gave the warning. So I don't think I have to say it again, but there's a reason why they're degrading our images. It's not just because it's fun. That's one of the reasons. It's because it accomplishes a certain agenda. And, we've got to stop it or accept the consequences.
Pamela Evans Harris. Context of white supremacy. Much obliged. Our narrator, co-narrator, read in Las Vegas. What was your question that you wanted to ask?
Yes, real quick. I know on the cows that Daniel Holt's call has been referenced and discussed a lot, but I wonder if that would count towards, I know this says it's not necessarily, he wasn't sentenced to death, but white people are still feeling like he was over sentenced. Would he be considered, or would he be one of those rare cases where a white male, if he would be considered white, was convicted for raping black females? That's the only question I had, if he would be classified as white and one of those whites who were raping black females. Thank you.
I guess it would just depend on, you know, if you think he's someone who's classified, accepted as white. I know that came up when we were talking about that case back when it was happening, 2015 and 2016, but that came up quite a bit. I know some of the folks that we had on that were in Oklahoma City where this happened, they seemed to have no confusion or doubt that he is classified as white. That came up explicitly during the trial. I think one of the witnesses, one of the victims, one of the black females testified that he identified himself as being white when he was sexually terrorizing her. So, and this came, I think she said it was multiple pieces of testimony that came up, you know, where he was classified, indicated as white. So, you know, some of those folks had no ambiguity at all. I know other people, they did not think he was classified as a white person. So I guess it would just depend on, you know, your assessment of Mr. Holtzclaw, whether or not that counts as a white person being convicted of raping black females. Did other folks have questions or comments that they wanted to get in?
I had a question, Gus.
Yes, ma'am.
I wanted to say that I don't think he was white. I think that's why he got the time that he got. So the two questions are, the men, the white males who have raped black women and got, you know, time, did they get significant time? Like, how much time on average did they get? And the next thing was about the exculpatory evidence. Like, was it exculpatory toward all the accused or just one of them? Or And I think I had one more. It might have just been a statement that even, like, was it, is it proof that, is there proof really that he even lied? Because they could even be saying that to protect the rapist. And I'll clarify if I need to. I'm in my mind. Thanks, Gus.
Let's see. With the evidence, if memory serves, it's been some years since I looked at the details of the case, but if memory serves, it was, they did some sort of DNA testing on some of the clothing of Ms. Mangum, the victim. They did some DNA testing, and the lab results that came back from the lab, I think it identified DNA samples from individuals other than the suspects. I don't think any of their DNA came up. I could be in error about that. I'll have to go back to double check, but I think they excluded that. They changed it around, or he did something where he was supposed to just release all of that that they got back, but he did some sort of cherry picking with the data, and it took them getting the person, the actual person who conducted the DNA test on the stand to ask him direct questions, and that's how they got the information that he had lied about the evidence. He had not presented all of the information from the test. Let's see. Did they present actual proof that he lied? I do not recall exactly like what he, if they were just saying it was the evidence aspect that he lied, or if there were additional statements. So I would have to go back to see the exact details about the deception. And you had, what was the other question? There was two, there was one other.
Yes, did the, did the people who, the white males who were accused of, who were convicted of raping black women, did they get a significant time? And if I may add one more real quick, do you think it's possible that that whole thing was just a lie and a fake trial like the Trayvon Martin trial? What I mean is that he really didn't exclude any evidence, and they're just saying that for one because he has a reputation of that, and they're that he probably did that in the case of black people, but in this case with the rape, he didn't really do that, and they're just saying that to protect these rapists.
That could be that, you know, maybe he didn't. I would tend to think that is not the case until somebody brought forth some evidence that, yeah, this is not what happened. And what happened was they really did this rape, and they just made this up that he lied about the evidence or what have you, just to kind of get rid of this guy, because it would have been really easy if that were the case to then throw in, oh yeah, and he's been doing this for years, and whatever the case, it would have been easy to do that. Some of that's, you know, coming out with the Daryl Howard piece, and then they could have blamed it all on this one guy. They could have got everybody off and just said, oh, it's this one rogue guy. That's not the way that they did things. They didn't even talk about it in that. And again, I'm not saying that these lacrosse players are innocent. Not at all. Just saying that, as I said before, you have one set of racists and you have another racist, Mr. Nifong individually, and I guess whoever else was associated with the crime. With the sentences, I don't know like every single case of a white person being convicted. I know the case that I mentioned, Billie Jean Owens, in that case, they got life sentences. It was multiple whites who were convicted in that case. But I would have to like look at the list to see the types of sentences that they are getting. If I were to wager, I would suspect it's probably significantly shorter than, you know, the typical sentences that you would see for rape convictions. I mean, that is our, I mean, logic would suggest that automatically, just because there are no death penalty convictions for white males where there was a black female victim. But the case that I knew of, they got life sentences. Did that answer the other two questions?
Absolutely. Thank you so much. And thanks, Red. You're doing a great job with this reading. You're very, very polished. I'm in my line.
Bravo. Absolutely. Great job to the narrators. Outstanding work. Other folks have questions, comments?
Gus. No, I watched that documentary, and I tend to think that it was a setup too. I kind of taken a position I did because I thought, and of course I didn't know about this other case, but these rich white boys, you know, was able to dig up some, you know, make up some stuff. I mean, that's just how I took it. I guess I did. I looked at it already judging it from a certain perspective, so I'm gonna have to rehash it. And I do remember that show, Frank's Place. That's an old show. My stepfather used to, and my mother, you know, they used to watch it. So I used to sit there and watch it with them. And it was a very positive black show. You know, I don't remember the concepts of it, but I do remember that was something that a lot of, you know, people classified as black watched. And they took it off and people were very upset because they couldn't figure out why. But now, after hearing Pam's comics every year, they didn't have any conflict. So, yeah, of course, that has to go. That was all I had to say.
Much obliged, Thomas in New York. Did other folks have questions, comments they wanted to share?
Can I be heard?
Retired firefighter, fresh from Winn-Dixie.
Is it relevant to also include that I notice on television there is a tremendous upsurge of commercials where they have either a non-white female with a white male in a perceivably functional relationship. And I think it has something to do with trying to confirm to non-white females, non-white black females, that yes, this is a good idea that you may want to try. And also they have it also where you would see sometimes the opposite with a black male and a white female, but overwhelmingly the scenario that I've seen on commercials, I mean, it's like a super amount of commercials where there is a non-white female and a white male, and it'd be some children to presume that those children belong to both of them. Because let's say it's a less melanated non-white female, the children would also have the same complexion, a similar complexion. I'm looking at where someone is actually doing the painstaking work to hire, in the case of, you know, these actors, you know, that sort of thing, to hire this blending of people to further convince non-white people that's a viable option, quote unquote, in the destruction of non-white black people. I was just wondering if that's relevant in this conversation. That I've seen that a whole lot lately. That's it.
Excuse me. Oh, was there somebody who was?
Yes, if I could say one other thing. There was an actress in Hollywood. I believe she played in the movie Django, and she was married to a white man. They were out in public, and I believe she was sitting in his lap, and they were kissing. And so someone called in the police. The police came out, arrested her for solicitation, and it was a big thing about it. It was on the news. The white guy was standing there. I guess, you know, he was powerless to do anything about it, but she was arrested, and she, you know, made a big stink about that, how, you know, they perceived her to be a prostitute and she was actually the man's wife. But it validates what Pam's talking about, the degradation of black females. And there's one other thing. Man, I forgot it that quick. It was about Gus, yeah, I want you to remind us. That was a guest on your show. I believe he was a black male, and for some reason, he was caretaker to a young white female. And he told us some of the predicaments and incidents that happened to him being a guardian or a parent of a white child. And so I'll mute my line on that. Thanks, Scott.
Mark Riding, 2009. October 2009. It'll be 9 years next month he was on the program. But, yeah, his mother-in-law was a foster parent. She, black female, of course. She, or maybe not of course, but black female. She took custody of a, like, six-year-old. She might have been even younger at the time when she got her, but very young white female. She ended up getting permanent custody of her, I believe, adopting her. And Mr. Riding, since he's younger, this is his mother-in-law, since he's younger, and he and his black wife, they have black children, I think at least two, or maybe more by now, but at least two. And they were closer to this white girl's age. They would bring her along with their family so she could be around children her same age and they have more energy, all of that. But yeah, he talked about all this on the program and the hateful looks and racist glares that he gets from people when he's out in public, and how they look at him as though he's doing something massively wicked and vile, being with this young suspected race soldier. Anyway, but that's in the archives, 2009, October. Other folks have a question, comment they need to get in?
I just wanted to say,
go ahead.
I'm sorry. I just wanted to say thank you to Ivy. I'm doing my line. Thank you.
Red just yielded to me, Gus?
I reckon so.
Okay, because I didn't hear well. Well, I was just going to ask, it's a personal question. This is this is traumatic for me still, with Pam being gone. And so you, Gus, you knew her personally. And so my question is, you know, how are you holding up? And I even wonder about everybody, how they're doing, and if it's even difficult for a resident expert to even read the book. So, yeah, that's my question. Like, how are you holding up? How are you doing? I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Always write poorly. She is certainly missed, and she was someone who was super supportive of the program and my attempted efforts to counter racism, white supremacy. So I certainly miss her, and it has been sad, unpleasant, whatever other words, describers you would like to employ. But it has been, I think, constructive being able to study her work, go back through the archives and get out some of the many, 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 many times that she was on the program to share constructive information. I think there are a lot of folks who said that they, even though they had heard and appreciated her commentary on the program all these years, they had not read her work, or maybe they had read one and not, you know, the rest of them, or they got started and stopped. So, you know, using this as an opportunity to motivate people to be active, that has been helpful. Not calling it stoic per se, but I do think it is correct to just be mindful that, you know, war is being waged against us at all times. Black people are dying constantly. Gwen Ifill was mentioned in the text. We read her book on the book club way back in 2016 as well. But black people are dying and being killed all the time. So just keeping that in mind, at least for me, helps me to kind of keep things in a correct perspective, to not allow myself to get too intensely sad about, you know, one individual death or one individual victim of abuse, even if that victim is me, because that's happening to billions of non-white people all over the world. So that's why we need to get cracking and get this problem solved. But holding as best one can and trying to use it in the most constructive manner possible. I think that's what you would want, anything to help encourage other non-white people to be active in the effort to solve this problem. Any other folks on Ivy's question? Yes, ma'am.
This is Rand in Las Vegas. I was just saying thank you to Ivy, and then to her question, and she said something about it's hard to read it. I know I'm you know, kind of new to the trials too. Only been listening for a few years, so I didn't really get to participate in a lot of shows with Pam. I know I remember one of the last ones I was listening live. The only thing, and I actually like reading the book because it kind of helps me to better understand her thoughts. The only thing that I feel like I had trouble with, I know, you know, just certain parts, just not only listening, but, you know, just reading it, like, you know, it really kind of like sinks in as far as, you know, the rape part. And then like, even like the part about Sojourner Truth, sometimes that was kind of difficult because I'm like, you know, this is actually, I don't know, this is different when you're reading something instead of it being read to you or like watching it as far as like the direct acts of racism. But that's it. Now I'll meet my line. Thank you.
Can I be heard?
Retired firefighter.
Yes. What comes to my mind that helps me with death in general is understanding that the global system of racist white supremacy places non-white people, especially non-white black people, in war conditions, under war conditions. I know it may not be easy for a lot of non-white people to see things in that way when you can sometimes sit and watch a color television. And you would say, well, one would say, well, what is he talking about? There's no bullets flying, you know, but they are. They may be right outside your house, you know, as far as that's concerned. But the system of racism, white supremacy is war. And in turn, you know, our lifetimes have limitations to it. But one thing that I understand about Ms. Evans is that, you know, a few of us are able to write a little bit. It's something that's called a diary. And people that is surrounding that person or may know that person may have the benefit of reading that diary and whatnot, that sort of thing. She has actually been a part of, what, four books, you know, on the very subject that I'm talking about, where she was attempting to be a part of dismantling what the problems that she talks about in her books. And that certainly is a, I would say, a very good thing, you know, in place of her death. And, you know, people are missing her, and, you know, I'm missing her, you know, from that standpoint, as far as her coming on the program. I just got to keep stating that over and over again in my mind about what I observed about her. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Much obliged. We will pause here so we can do the second audio segment. And I'll give out the number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. To Ivy's question, quickly, the WRAL, North Carolina news outlet, they report in May, Mr. Nifong, this is the disbarred white prosecutor, released that initial report to defense attorneys who quickly trumped the news that DNA security had been unable to find a conclusive match between the accuser, Crystal Mangum, and any lacrosse players. It was not until much later, however, that the defense received the background details of the test results, which indicated there was genetic material from several males found in the accuser's underwear and body, but none from any member of the lacrosse team. There's more in the report, but that was to the question about the specifics of the DNA. We'll get to the second audio segment, Context of White Supremacy. Pam the Great, if you had a hand up and didn't get to share, just make a note and we will get to you once the second audio segment concludes. Black Love is a revolutionary act. Audio segment number two, The Cows.
Chapter 32, The Tyranny of Men. I told you I was defending myself. If I gotta do this anger counseling shit, her ass should be sitting right here with me. The young woman punctuated the sentence by punching her fist into an open palm. She was barely 20, thick-bodied, with a pecan brown complexion. Karen King, an anger management specialist for the Murrow County Court System, sat stoic-faced in a chair a few feet away. It was going to take more than four sessions to crack through her client's tough, defensive shell and get her to take responsibility for breaking her ex-lover's arm. That wasn't surprising, considering the counseling had not been voluntary. The domestic violence judge had sentenced Leslie to 10 weeks of anger management after her female partner declined to press assault charges. Karen was well aware of the difficulty with dealing with a reluctant client, especially one who was extremely angry from what Karen suspected was childhood sexual abuse. The first thing she usually established during their first session was the obvious, that sitting in her office for an hour twice a week was preferable to sitting in a jail cell. When Karen glanced at her watch, Leslie jumped to her feet. "We finished?" Her tone was hopeful. "Next week, same time, and Leslie?" Karen put a little steel in her voice, making Leslie pause at the door. "Same time means be on time." Karen shook her head as the door slammed, then scribbled some notes in an open file. She just didn't get it. It was a phenomenon as alarming and puzzling as the AIDS epidemic in the black community. Over the last several years, Karen had noticed a stark increase in the number of bisexual and homosexual black women, especially under the age of 40. Karen didn't buy the bisexual label. In her experience, it was rare to find a man or woman who was equally attracted to both sexes and didn't have a preference. She believed some had adopted the bisexual label because of the stigma of being a full-out homosexual. Then there were people like a client, Nina, a 34-year-old black pharmacist who said she knew she was gay by the age of 9 but had married out of peer pressure from her family. Karen believed the new generation of lesbians were not lesbians at all, but were acting out sexually because they perceived men as a threat to their emotional and physical well-being. With the rise of HIV infections in the black community, some black women felt safer sexually with other women. Some wanted to reject men as they had been rejected, especially if they didn't fit the stereotype of black beauty. The black male shortage forced others to seek love wherever they could find it. Whatever their reasons, the emotional and sexual disconnection from men often represented a significant power play on their part. Over drinks at a psychiatric symposium last year, Karen met Phyllis, a 46-year-old black physician who, after taking her first female lover 4 years ago, admitted she felt free for the first time in her life from the crippling beauty standards forced on her by society and by black men. Phyllis said her black female lover wasn't threatened by a successful black woman since she was one herself. After she stopped beating herself up for not having longer hair or lighter skin, her attitude towards black women, especially the vanilla cream, long-haired girls she once envied, greatly improved because she wasn't competing for the attention or approval of men. Phyllis's story mirrored what another female client, a 32-year-old single mother, told Karen. She turned to women for her emotional needs after she ended an abusive relationship with the father of her two children. She said, being with women freed her from the tyranny of men. In the privacy of Karen's office, more and more black female clients echoed similar sentiments that dealing with men offered more risks than rewards because they never felt valued in those relationships. The handful who dated white males exclusively admitted they still felt undermined if they were, as one black female surgeon said, too uppity. The feelings of alienation were even more profound among her darker complexion clients like Francine, a beautiful 40-something lawyer who had recently divorced her husband of 18 years after discovering he had a series of affairs with white women. Her ex-husband's parting shot was his bizarre confession that he started sleeping with white women because dark-skinned women weren't sexy. Francine said that she could have forgiven him for almost anything, but that since he knew about her issues growing up as the darkest one in her family. Just a few hours after his confession, Francine committed her first act of violence against another human being. While her soon-to-be ex-husband dozed on the living room sofa, Francine poured an entire bottle of scotch on the cushions and set them on fire. Luckily, only the sofa was damaged. Francine was charged with domestic violence and court-ordered to do 12 weeks of anger management at her expense or lose her law license. Karen patiently explained to Francine that her husband said what he said to hurt her after she refused to call off the divorce. Obviously, he found dark-skinned women attractive enough to marry since no one put a gun to his head and forced him to walk down the aisle. After 2 months of counseling, Francine was still a work in progress. Karen understood firsthand the pain and anger that ran deep in many black women's psyches despite their accomplishments and sophisticated polish. The daily assault on their self-esteem was seldom acknowledged, so many suffered in silence until their rage was too great to keep inside. Even though the background details differed, some of Karen's white female clients echoed a similar desire to disconnect emotionally from men. Some had stopped dating men or dated men of color exclusively and were unapologetic about it. They claimed that black and Hispanic men were less judgmental about their physical imperfections and didn't expect a woman to look like something out of a Playboy centerfold. It was fascinating and extremely frustrating to hear her white female clients say they felt validated by black men versus her black female clients who often felt the opposite. In spite of that, her female clients had more in common than not. Most had come from a dysfunctional family background. Some were victims of rape, physical abuse, or incest. More than half were single or divorced mothers and had an emotionally distant or physically abusive father, while a third hadn't known their fathers at all. What ultimately brought them all to Karen's office was their inability to cope with their own pain and rage without resorting to self-destructive behaviors, or their personal relationships escalated into violent confrontations that landed them in court or mandatory anger management counseling. The biggest thing that separated her lesbian clients from the heterosexual ones was their unwillingness to be sexually involved with men. While Karen fully understood their disenchantment with the opposite sex, the rising trend of disconnection between black men and women greatly concerned her. How would the black community survive if black men and women stopped turning to each other and started turning to the same sex or to another race? What would happen to their children? What was happening to black children? She already had part of the answer. The luckier ones sat in an office like hers, where a trained professional would give them half a fighting chance at dealing with their pain. The less fortunate ones either wound up in jail or in the graveyard. After 18 years in the mental health field, Karen understood why some of her colleagues were actively pursuing second careers. The professional term was burnout, but in reality, they were fed up. It was stressful enough dealing with your own baggage without carrying someone else's, knowing in the end you couldn't relieve their load. The last and sometimes only recourse was prescribing medication. Karen considered drug therapy for emotional issues an absolute admission of failure on the part of the therapist, cloaked in impressive-sounding medical jargon. As she finished up some paperwork, she kept thinking about Francine, the divorced lawyer who had broken down in her office earlier that afternoon. Francine had asked, through tears, how black men could say the same ugly things about black women that white racists said. It was the question of the decade, as far as Karen was concerned, one she didn't try to answer. Absently, she opened a small mirrored compact and dabbed a bit of powder on her chocolate brown nose, chin, and forehead. Still single, still looking, but a lot less hopeful. She frowned at her reflection. How long had it been since a man found her attractive? After shoving some papers into a leather briefcase, she turned out the lights and locked the office door behind her. Thank God the work day was done. The end. Recipe number 11. Demonize the black male. 6 reasons black males are demonized in a white supremacy society. Why are black males degraded in America? Reason number 1. To transform 500 years of brutality, rape, and murder of black males into white fear and innocence. It is illogical to believe that white people, who control every institution in America, including education, employment, and law enforcement, would be afraid of any black male who is powerless to even stop one civil servant armed with a badge and a gun from snuffing out his life. The men who should be the most afraid are the ones whose lives have no value. Umoja. It is an indisputable fact that the black male is the most brutalized and dehumanized man in American history. He has been enslaved, raped, lynched, burned alive, whipped, branded with hot irons, dismembered, castrated, exploited, slaughtered, and robbed of his language, history, land, inventions, music, dance, resources, culture, religion, freedom, even the right to protect or claim his women and children. The black male has been denied the right to earn a living wage or any living at all and deprived of an equal education and equal justice under the law. He has been unjustly accused, imprisoned, and executed in the same nation he built with his sweat, blood, and tears. The black male is the most likely person to be beaten, sodomized, or murdered by law enforcement, to be underemployed or unemployed regardless of experience or education, and to be stripped of his constitutional, God-given right to own a firearm to protect himself and his family than any other man or woman in America. After 500 years of documented abuse, rape, exploitation, and murder, how was the most powerless man in America, the black male, been cast as the most feared and dangerous? There is only one possible answer: the mainstream media. The black male has been transformed from a victim of white supremacy into a living, breathing, walking, and talking stereotype of a rapist, criminal, monster, boogeyman, super predator, sex-crazed mandingo, the King Kong of all deadbeat fathers, and a convenient black scapegoat for all of America's social, political, and economic ills. Public enemy number 1, the black male. A common fear among the white collective is being raped or murdered by a black male. However, this false white fear flies in the face of reality and U.S. government statistics. According to a government report, 85% of white murder victims were slain by whites. The remaining 15% included blacks, Hispanics, and other minorities. Rapes of white women by black men represent less than 10% of all rapes, according to the Justice Department. Where incest, rape, and murder are concerned, white females have more to fear from white males, their fathers, uncles, teachers, neighbors, husbands, and boyfriends, than they do from black males. The false innocence and the MUBL, the mysterious unidentified black male. The black boogie male did it has become the standard excuse by white male and female criminals who are trying to escape responsibility or punishment for their own horrendous crimes. 1969, Charles Manson sent Manson family members to the home of actress Sharon Tate, where 5 people were murdered in cold blood. Manson family killers wrote the word pig in Sharon Tate's blood on the front door of the residence, possibly to infer that the Black Panthers had committed the crime. According to prosecutors, Charles Manson hoped his murder spree would provoke a race war between blacks and whites. 1989, Charles Chuck Stewart, a white male, murdered his pregnant wife, Carol, then told the police that a black gunman forced his way into their car, robbed them, and murdered his wife. Stewart's brother, Matthew, admitted he saw his brother shoot his wife, then shoot himself to support his false story. On January 4, 1990, Stewart jumped from the Tobin Bridge to his death. 1994, Susan Smith, a white female, murdered her two boys by driving her auto into a lake while the children slept in their car seats, initially reporting to police that she had been carjacked by a black man. 9 days later, after an intense, heavily publicized investigation and nationwide search, Smith confessed to drowning her children. 2003, Brian Wells, a white male pizza delivery man, told police that a group of black men had taken him hostage, locked a bomb around his neck, and forced him to rob a bank. He was killed when the bomb exploded. Later, police discovered that Wells and a few of his white friends had cooked up the entire scheme. 2007, Amanda Knox, a white female American exchange student living in Italy, was convicted in the 2007 stabbing death of her British roommate, Meredith Kircher. Knox initially tried to pin the blame on a black man, Patrick L., the owner of the La Chic Bar. The reggae musician was locked up on murder charges, but released after 10 days when his alibi checked out. 2007, DNA test clears man after 27 years. A man enjoyed freedom Tuesday for the first time in nearly three decades after a DNA test proved he did not commit a 1979 rape. According to the Justice Department, rapes of white women by black men represent less than 10% of all rapes. Half of all rape exonerations were black men who were falsely convicted of raping white women. Source, Atlanta Associated Press, 2007. 2008, Ashley Todd, a white female Republican, claimed that she was assaulted by a black male Obama supporter who carved a backwards B on her face. She later admitted she had fabricated, lied, and had assaulted herself. 2009, Bonnie Sweeten, a white female, claimed two black men had abducted her and her 9-year-old daughter after a fender bender and stuffed them into the trunk of a black Cadillac. It was later discovered that the abduction was a hoax and that Sweeten had fled to Disney World with her daughter. Sweeten was later indicted for allegedly stealing $700,000 from her employer, a Bucks County law firm. 2010, Robert Ralston, a white male Philadelphia police sergeant, claimed he was shot by an unidentified black man, but police later discovered that he had shot himself and had fabricated the entire story, lied to look like a hero. 2010, Conrad Zerderak, a white male, robbed four banks and a CVS pharmacy wearing a black man mask. Central Park jogger rape convictions tossed. Five men cleared after DNA implicates another man for a 1989 attack. 13 years after the brutal rape and beating of a Central Park jogger, a judge on Thursday dismissed the convictions of all five men who served prison time for the attack. After spending nearly 15 years in prison for a rape murder they didn't commit, three young black men were given gilt edge plaques etched with today's date and a simple message, the first day of the rest of your life. A massive insult on top of a massive injury. News, media, entertainment industry. When it comes to the evening news, black males are more likely to be seen wearing handcuffs than a tailored suit or surgeon scrubs. The majority of images portray black males as natural-born criminals, clowns, TV court jesters, thugs, pimps, bullies, drug dealers, hustlers, deadbeat baby daddies, fools, and animalistic brutes. When it comes to Hollywood and TV roles, black males are usually limited to one of four roles: the crooked or straight cop, the criminal, the clown, or the sexual predator. The images of successful black males are usually limited to entertainers, actors, athletes, comedians, sitcom buffoons, dancers, and politicians. With a few exceptions, black males are usually portrayed as more brawn, muscle, than brains. In contrast, white males are usually shown as having more brains than brawn, and often have an impressive amount of both. Domestic terrorism of black males by law enforcement. The stereotype of black males as violent criminals is used to justify abuse and murder of black males by law enforcement, regardless of the facts or any videotaped evidence of the Rodney King beating. Documented torture methods by Chicago police. From 1972 to 1991, over 200 black men were tortured by Chicago Police Commander John G. Berg and other Chicago detectives to obtain confessions. In 2008, Berg was living in Florida on a Chicago police pension and was arrested for lying in court during a civil lawsuit, not for torturing black males. Suffocation with the plastic cover of a typewriter, being battered with phone books, burned with cigarettes and radiators, threatened with handguns, electrically shocked with a telephone generator, cattle prod applied to men's nipples, genitals, and rectal interiors. Jeremiah Mirday versus Chicago Police. I didn't know my son, Jeremiah's father said when he went to the hospital on September 26, 1997. He was a bloody mess. He had two holes knocked in the top of his head, his five front upper teeth along with the gum severed, and a broken jaw. They stomped him in his stomach, and there was trauma to his back. Revolutionary Worker newspaper, number 934, September 30, 1997. 1997, Jeremiah Mirday, an unarmed 18-year-old black male, was kicked and beaten with flashlights by two white Chicago police officers for no apparent reason. After the beating, Mirday was hospitalized with a broken jaw and head injuries. On November 7th, nearly 200 white police officers forced Jeremiah Mirday and his attorneys to walk the gauntlet of intimidation in a Chicago courtroom. This Gestapo display, which was tolerated by the presiding judge, was met by protest and outrage by Mirday's supporters. 5 years later, the city of Chicago agreed to pay Jeremiah Mirday $1.75 million to settle the police brutality case if he dropped his lawsuit. Driving while black, DWB. Driving while black should be called driving while white people are being white. Dr. Kamau Kamban. Racial profiling refers to a police officer or a person of authority who harasses or arrests non-whites because they are not white. In many cases, racial profiling is encouraged by white city officials to send a message to blacks, especially black males, are not welcome to live, work, shop, or even drive through certain white areas. It is a psychological tool of intimidation and demoralization used against black males to remind them that they are inferior, unequal, and will not receive the same courtesy and rights that whites take for granted. Rogue cops caught on videotape is psychological terrorism. Why would the same mainstream media that portrays black males as natural-born criminals also broadcast the videotape evidence that prove that black males are the victims of law enforcement? One possible reason, to remind, terrorize black males that at any time, any place, and for no reason whatsoever, their rights can be violated by law enforcement. This psychological tool of terrorism is a continuation of the same process that began during slavery to instill fear in the black male so he will not rebel against the very white systems that oppress him. Axiom number 6. The black victim equals a victimless crime theory. A black person in a conflict with a white person or a white system cannot be the victim in a white supremacy society. The black individual is always at fault, regardless of who initiated the conflict or what facts or evidence are present. Reason number 2, to destroy the black male intellectual potential. Only 12% of African American males are proficient in reading by 8th grade. If a boy is not on grade level of reading by the end of 1st grade, they only have a 20% chance of reaching grade level by 12th grade. Dr. Jawanza Kanjufu, author of The Conspiracy to Destroy Black Boys. In America's public schools, black boys are more likely to be tracked into special education, remedial, and vocational classes, excluded from gifted programs and college preparatory classes, given the drug Ritalin for behavior problems, labeled as mentally disabled when they are not, suspended, expelled more often than white students for same offenses, score lower on standardized tests, drop out before completing high school. What happens to the intellectual potential of black boys in a school system that is designed to provide an inferior education? What happens to their intellectual ambition if the most influential adults in their lives, the teachers, school administrators, politicians, the media, and sometimes even their own parents, think they're incapable of learning? Can the answer be found in the lower test scores and higher dropout rates for black boys? Brawn vs. Brains. I'm going to be a rapper or play pro ball. Why should I go to college? College won't make me rich. Jamal, 23-year-old black male. Why are black boys being programmed to think that being black, male, and book smart do not go together, and their best and only chance for success is to become an entertainer or a pro ball player? So why won't they pursue the mental and occupational skills necessary to build an independent, self-sustaining society? Doctors, scholars, authors, lawyers, engineers, chemists, scientists, physicists, programmers, accountants, mathematicians, builders, inventors, and manufacturers. Derailing the educational potential in black boys guarantees a population of black male slaves who will always be dependent on other men for their basic needs and will remain in an easily exploited and easily enslaved population. We cannot afford to ignore the facts. There is a national agenda to destroy the intellectual potential of black boys. While white boys of privilege are trained to be masters of the universe, black boys are trained to be the future candidates for the prison industrial complex. Chapter 34, Flipping the Educational Script. Scene: a giant meteor explodes in space and showers cosmic dust over every square inch of the United States. By morning, black people have traded places with white people in all areas of human activity, and both think it has always been that way. Setting: a small town in the heartland of America. From kindergarten to high school, white children are taught history from a made-up super Afrocentric viewpoint, meaning black people created, discovered, and invented anything of any importance. The white students are secretly ashamed because their history books prove whites contributed nothing to art, history, medicine, science, or civilization. All they have is February, the shortest month of the year, to learn the same tidbits of white history. Most stopped caring years ago. Teachers are harder on the white students, even though the black students goof off and can't answer the teacher's questions either. By grammar school, 25% of white boys are in special education classes because the teachers say they don't read and write as well as the other black students. The little white girls prefer black dolls because they are prettier and love reading about the adventures of black Nancy Drew, wishing they were black too. Little white boys play with black army men and read comic books about black superheroes, since there are no white ones. On Saturday afternoons, the little white boys and girls in town line up to see the latest black Harry Potter movie and cheer when good black triumphs over evil white. In the evening after supper, they watch their favorite TV shows. Most of the faces are black, sprinkled with a few white faces and a handful of white women who are mostly fat and unattractive. By the age of 6, the little girls and boys believe that the prettiest women are black because that's what they see on TV, in movies, and magazines. Once in a while, there are one or two pretty white women, but they look more black than white. The children never question this because they believe this is normal. In the integrated high school, most of the white students are tracked into the vocational courses, while most of the black students take college-bound courses. There was a cheating scandal about the placement test that got their previous principal fired last year, but it was swept under the rug by the powerful school board made up of mostly black parents. As a gesture of goodwill, the girls' athletic coach chooses a white girl to be a cheerleader, even though most of the football and basketball players are white. When the black parents discover one of the history teachers, the only white teacher, created a white history course to motivate the white students, the black parents threaten to boycott the school. At the local school board meeting, one of the black parents explains her opposition to teaching white history by saying, "I don't think any one group should be studied. Plus, it makes whites feel really bad about their race when they actually did not have anything to do with it." A black father adds, "Isn't white history already taught in history class? As far as I know, my kids learned about Tom Sawyer and Frank Sinatra, so what's the problem?" To appease the black parents, the school board suspends the white teacher for a week. The white parents retreat in angry silence, hesitant to push the issue because some of the black parents in the room are their employers and bosses. Upon learning of the white teacher's suspension, the white students become even more demoralized than before. A month after the school board meeting, a white boy and a black boy get into a fight. Neither one was hurt, but the principal calls the police anyway. The white boy was arrested and permanently expelled, but the black boy only got a week in detention. The white kids are angered, scared, and shocked that a simple schoolyard fight could result in a felony conviction and a permanent criminal record for their 17-year-old white classmate. After their schoolmate was expelled, the slow white boys, who have been in special education classes since grammar school and were permanently labeled as educationally challenged, started dropping out of high school. The white boys said they were tired of being put down in front of the other kids. Besides, what was the point of staying in school when everyone said white boys had no future? The end. Can you imagine white parents tolerating this kind of abuse against their children from their school system? Then why the hell are we? Tragically, it appears the war against the intellectual potential of black boys has been largely successful. According to the SHOT 50 State Report on Public Education, only 47% of black males graduate from high school. In cities like Dade County, Florida, Cleveland, Ohio, and Detroit, Michigan, the graduation rate is as low as 27%. According to a 2010 report by the Council of the Great City Schools, black boys drop out of high school at twice the rate of white boys, and that black men represented only 5% of college students in 2008. Reason number 3, to program young black males to believe going to prison is a rite of passage to black manhood. It is obvious the mainstream media is glamorizing black male hip-hop celebrities who have been charged with and or convicted of crimes or who have served time in prison. The list is too long for this book, but includes Tupac Shakur, Chris Brown, Beanie Siegel, Flesh and Bone, T.I., Steady B, Mac, Lil Bootsy, Cassidy, Sadat X, Royce da 5'9", Mano, Styles P, Kool C, Lil Wayne, Black Rob, Mystical, Gucci Mane, John Forte, DMX, Chill Ali, Prodigy, C Murda, Da Brat, Shine, and Pimp C. The revolving prison door for young black male celebrities appears to be part of a bigger scheme to promote the prison lifestyle to the impressionable young black males, especially poor black males, as the only true rite of passage into black manhood. Are these jail-prone and criminally inclined black celebrities innocent stooges and victims, or have they been promised more fame and money in exchange for making their mostly poor black male fans a psychological and social blood sacrifice to the system of white supremacy? This is not an unreasonable assumption, since there is ample evidence that the white supremacy system is grooming young black males as future prison inmates instead of doctors, lawyers, and engineers. According to an article entitled, T.I., The Longer I Sit, The Smarter I Get, rapper T.I., in a letter to his fans after being jailed for drug possession, claims he is doing better locked up. T.I. also adds, it doesn't matter how long it'll be before the next time you see me. What matters is that I'll be a better man before that time comes. The longer I sit, the smarter I get. Source: The Urban Daily. The responses from T.I.'s fans confirms our suspicions. T.I. is one of the best rappers in the world. He is only human. Everybody makes mistakes. I support him 100%. He still sells albums. He's making money while he is in jail. When he gets out, he is not only going to be smarter, but being a better person as a father and a celebrity. If y'all don't realize when you in jail, all you do is write, so I would not be surprised if made 2 or 3 albums while he is locked up. Look at Tupac. He is the greatest rapper ever, and most of his stuff he wrote in jail. And there it is. He kept it G and still gonna sell a hit. Do work, T.I. T.I. ain't no joke. God sent a strong, black, positive young man that is giving back to the community, and they can't stand that, so they tries to sit you down. In just one generation, a felony conviction has more status for some young black males than a college degree. If sagging pants could talk, they might say, look at him, white people. He's no threat to anyone but himself. He is not that strong black man you fear, hate, and want to destroy. In fact, he's not a man at all. He will spend every waking moment proving he's as harmless as a child, so you won't harm or kill him the way he has seen you destroy strong, masculine black men. Even though he lives in some of the nation's most dangerous neighborhoods, he can't run from danger. He can hardly walk. He is a harmless, most comical nuisance in his sagging pants and an eyesore to anyone who lays eyes on him. By wearing me, he is submitting to his own black male inferiority and has waved the white flag of heterosexual black male surrender with just a few yards of fabric. If I could talk, I'd say a job well done. FYI, sagging spelled backwards is niggas. Sagging pants, hanging off the ass. Where did the sagging pants style come from? There are two explanations floating around. One explanation is homosexual inmates in New York State often wore sagging pants for easy sexual access, a signal that they were sexually available to other male inmates. The second explanation is prisoners were forced to wear pants without belts because their belts could be used as weapons or to commit suicide by hanging, so their beltless pants sagged. Some black males claim wearing sagging pants is no different than wearing baggy pants. However, they have overlooked one big difference between the two. Baggy pants were created by professional clothing designers whose profits allow them to buy cars, homes, and stock portfolios. Sagging pants were created by inmates who own nothing, including the right to own a belt. There is a more troubling imagery associated with sagging pants. The sight of young black males walking, shuffling like slaves who have their ankles shackled together. Slave tradition or future rape victim. Why are some young black males so eager to belong to the modern-day slave plantation, aka the prison industrial complex, that they mimic the prison chic of modern-day black male slaves? Sagging pants may be a symptom of the collective low self-esteem that plagues young black males in America, and a subconscious way of using fashion as camouflage against the relentless attacks against the masculine black male in American society. For the young black male who has witnessed the wanton destruction and murder of black males by white authority figures, he may be terrified of being seen as a black man, a threat, and wants nothing more than to blend into the background, stay in the dark, and stay in his place. Putting on a pair of sagging pants may be the least expensive and easiest way to do it. There is a different risk associated with wearing sagging pants. Fleece Johnson is a long-term inmate at Kentucky State Penitentiary who was profiled during an episode of Lockup. He shamelessly admitted to raping other male inmates and delivered a dire warning to the new generation of inmates that they asking for trouble from old-timers like himself. You know, they got this thing where they sags their pants past their butt, you know? It's sexy to us, right? So you sag your pants in here, man. Somebody will be up in your butt. It's just that simple. Source, MSNBC, Lockup Prison Show. In 2008, just 2 weeks before the November election of America's first black president, Barack Obama, two noteworthy events occurred. On October 15, 2008, Comedy Central created a fake news show, which was hosted by black comic David Alan Greer, replete with stereotypes of black males as criminals, gangbangers, and transvestites. Not to be outdone, or perhaps by mutual agreement, on October 25, 2008, cable news giant CNN hosted its first comedy news show, the first show hosted by a black male, D.L. Hughley Breaks the News, which featured hilarious skits that included pimp and pork chop jokes. In March 2009, just 2 months after Obama was inaugurated as president, both shows were abruptly canceled. One can only assume that black comics Greer and Hughley had outlived their usefulness. The images of two black male entertainers promoting black buffoonery balanced the image of the articulate, educated black male Barack Obama. The degraded black male image had been restored. Reason number four, to impoverish the black male. What is the definition of a man? The most basic definition is a provider and a protector of his women and children. What happens to the morale of a man who is relentlessly and persistently denied that God-given right? The answer to that question can be found in the 500-year history of the black man in America, Umoja.
And that is where we will pick up at for next Friday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, Context of White Supremacy, Pamela Evans Harris. Black love is a revolutionary act. If you have questions, thoughts, comments, the number to dial 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Incidentally, I forgot, Dr. Martin Kevorkian, admitted white supremacist, he was on the program in 2010. We discussed District 9, April 2010. We discussed District 9 in the context of white supremacy. That's the one, I believe it's set in South Africa, but he had a lot of interesting, I remember it took me forever to watch that film. Wow. Do not recommend anyone sitting through that. Folks that I'll double check to see if there are any folks that we've missed completely. If you did not get to share after the first audio segment and you have a question or comment that you would like to share, go ahead and get your hand up now. Please do not wait till the last minute. Codified software developer in Wisconsin. Yes, ma'am.
Good evening, Gus. Good evening to all the callers and listeners. I just wanted to comment on this discussion about black males. I think this is incredibly important. I think a lot of times black males are, in my opinion, the most marginalized group of people on the planet. I know a lot of educated black females who are saying the opposite, that it's black females, but when you look at the statistics of black males, their unemployment and underemployment, their educational levels, you have to really, really sort of admit to this, admit to the idea or the truth that black males are the most marginalized group of people on the planet. I would say second most, of course, is the black female. I thought it was really interesting the little synopsis that Red just read about D.L. Hughley David Allen Greer. And there were a host of other people who were hired during that time to be sort of, for lack of a better term, Obama whisperers, right? There were a lot of black people who were given positions, including the Reverend Al Sharpton, amongst other people who were given positions on various news networks and everything, who were subsequently let go after President Obama's, his tenure was ended. And so it really goes to show that, you know, the whole idea of, you know, even though there was this black male in the White House who was incredibly articulate and had this beautiful black family, even though he was there, the idea was still to ensure that the black male was not seen as articulate, and that their families were not seen as beautiful. And if I recall correctly, during Obama's tenure, there were several references to him as being articulate for a black guy or what have you, sort of qualifying his behavior because he was a black male. And just as an aside, you know, I spoke about this yesterday, editing this wedding video of this tragic arrangement. And, you know, I think that our black men are incredibly damaged to the point where, you know, they will accept abuse from white females because they feel that the white female is validating them in some way, and that's just due to, you know, conditioning. that we've all undergone. With that, I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Much obliged, Codified Software Developer. Irie, did you have commentary? You should be with us as well. Line should be open.
Yes, hello, everybody. Good evening. And I wanted to thank, I believe that was Ivy, correct, that asked how you were doing with Pam's death. That was very, very considerate. When I found out Pam passed away, I was utterly surprised because I had actually been listening to the archives, and she reminded me of my aunt who passed away due to complications with diabetes rather suddenly. It was a pretty awful departure for her. And Pam was more conscious than my aunt was, unfortunately, so that was something that I really appreciated, having listening to her candor about our situation. And there was two things that I had on my mind from this chapter and a thought from last week that I didn't get to share. When my son was entering kindergarten, his pre-K teacher, who was non-white, black, suggested to me that I lie and say that my son had either a speech impediment or a learning disability, so that way I wouldn't have to pay to have him in a school situation, a kindergarten school situation, and that way I would be able to insert him into a Head Start program, which would be free for me and possibly have some other benefits that I don't know what they are, but she thought that would be something I would go for. And I knew then that I didn't know about racism, white supremacy, but I knew I didn't want to lie and say that my son was slow, no matter what. And I can only imagine the advice, whether she was sent out to do that on purpose or whether she thought she was helping. I can only imagine how many people took that advice. Moving on. The other thought that I want to share is actually an interrogative. Is it correct to call tragic arrangements any situation where a black man or woman seeks a non-white or a non-black person for the sake of that, not being with somebody black? Like, I think about the young man that passed away in California. He said he didn't want anything black but Xbox, and he had an Asian wife. I live in an area that's getting more and more, like, it has more and more couples that are in tragic arrangements, and not all of them are a white, non-white, black, but some are non-white, black, and non-white something else. And it's like, it's looking like a form of escapism to me, and also a form of self-hatred just manifested in another way. Thank you, everybody, and I'll mute my line.
Much obliged for the commentary. I guess my answer to the question, tragic arrangement, using that term to apply to any situation where a black male or black female is engaged in some sort of sexual activity with any partner that is non-black, unless I have been misinformed, Neely Fuller Jr. is the person that coined that phrase, tragic arrangement, and I think he explicitly uses that term for any non-white person, not just black people, any non-white person who is engaged in any form of sexual activity, sexual arrangement with a person classified as white. And I'm of the opinion, just in terms of minimizing confusion, that there should be a different term if people want to label all of those arrangements with a black person specifically. And someone who is not black, there should be a different term chosen just to minimize confusion, because that's not the original definition that Mr. Fuller attached to it. And I could see how people could end up thinking that he had that thought that, yeah, tragic arrangements are supposed to be anytime a black person is not with another black person. And that's not what he said originally, even though I can certainly see the logic of that being a product of racism, white supremacy, anti-blackness, to partner with someone who is not black. Black, get back, get as far away from that as possible. Absolutely. I do not, that is not a part of my counter-racist code, however, to say that that is incorrect for a black person to be in some sort of sexual arrangement with a non-white, non-black person. That is not a part of my code. I just want to make sure I'm being open about that. Other folks, anybody that we missed completely that has a hand up? Anybody that we missed completely? Grand. Any other folks that have a hand up, if you have commentary that you would like to share, proceed.
Yes, may I be heard?
Mr. Demery Four.
Yes. This, well, she, the author started getting into, I guess, some of these experiences that women, I guess, this lady was a some type of specialist or psychologist. Anyway, these women were coming in and they were expressing, I guess, bisexual or, you know, same-sex loving. And she gave some reasons. And I don't know if I agree with them. But, you know, I guess any reason would be good. But dealing with men offered more risk than rewards, or that the women never felt valued in their relationships. One of them was saying that, you know, I guess she said something so damaging to her, she didn't, that would be something a white racist would say. But I think that, you know, for anyone, a male or a female, to take on a relationship, you know, with the same-sex individual, they would have to have some type of, you know, proclivity to that, whereas they would have a desire themselves, so they would have to share in the responsibility of making this choice rather than, you know, what actually happened to them that may have driven them to that type of action. So they just have to, you know, face up to they, you know, they wanted that and they went for it. But she mentioned something about the black community, which we know that, you know, situation that we're in right now, you can't really, there is no black community, but Dr. Wilson used to say, you know, when you play around with sex, then the children end up being the joke. So you have to think about the children. And I don't know about these statistics. You know, they were probably correct at the time, or, you know, statistics can be manipulated, but we get the point. And, you know, I just had to chuckle when, you know, she was talking about, I guess, the something happened, small town in hard time America, where everything was turned around. And the part of it said all they have is February, the shortest month of the year, to learn the same tidbits of white history. You know, it basically just kind of sums it up, you know. I mean, it's so pathetic. I mean, you really can't say too much about it. But I'll mute my line, guys. Let somebody else have a chance. Thanks. Take the call.
Appreciate it, Mr.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir, retired firefighter.
Yes, so I concur with your guess, what you was about to say. I appreciate the last caller. also. What comes to my mind, what Pam was speaking about accurately, is I call it psychological warfare, since I was talking about war the last time I said something. And I think this will go under the caption of psychological warfare, the second reading, with the different examples. As of at this particular point in time, we are already, non-white people I'm talking about, are already under a global system of racism, white supremacy. And they still have, they meaning the racists, still have enforcement, organized enforcement, as well as, you know, just about every, you know, white person is also a part of that, either actively or auxiliary-wise. But it's, I would call it, from an occupation point of view, more so than anything, not so much about, you know, battleships and whatnot on the seas and landing craft coming in to invade a people. That's already, that work has already been done. Primarily, they occupy the environments where we live and control, manipulate, and they have control over the environment. To whereas they meaning the races, understanding on the negative end of the relationships, that a high percentage, an acceptable percentage, of the people are going to be psychologically depraved. To the point to whereas the system of racist white supremacy can be maintained. As far as the active physical war, it's like patrolling and controlling, whether it is local, whether it's in a larger area that's called a nation, a national basis, and then you have the international base of enforcement. And she was making a point that I understand with greater confinement. When I was a much younger person, I had a neighbor who was 3 years older that was constantly going in and out of greater confinement. Now, mind you, he had both parents in the home, but he was constantly going in and out of greater confinement, at least maybe once or twice a year, to the point to whereas he's been in there now, he is approximately somewhere between 63 and 65 years old, and he's in there now. The last time he was incarcerated, it was for murder. But I do remember him when he used to be out. He would, you know, tell us what I would call prison stories. And basically everything that he was talking about 30 years ago, it is not limited to greater confinement. It's now considered to be normalcy within the environment in the more greater prison that is called, you know, wherever you stay at, wherever non-white people are allowed to stay at. It is more popular outside of the bars and the concrete than it is inside. It's just as much as far as that concern. And therefore, within non-white people, you see a lot of peculiar behaviors that are going on that Pam does speak to all through the book, actually. And in turn, what it does for me, it sums up on why black males and black females have problems individually and when we interact with one another. And so that is one of the key importance of this book, with someone who may need to have some sort of source reference to be able to put things together in their mind. This would be a good book to be able to accomplish that. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Yes, ma'am.
I didn't interrupt you there, did I?
No, ma'am.
Another time. Ari, you're very welcome as far as me asking everyone how they're doing. As far as Tim, as I said, it's pretty traumatic for me still. I agree with Mr. Demi Ford that, you know, how can I put this? I want to say this gently. None of these things that were mentioned are reasons to be a homosexual. You talk about thinking black men have diseases. Well, black women have the reputation of having diseases because white people lied on us and said half of us got herpes. So to say that, you know, black women are running away from black men who they think they got AIDS, who they think got AIDS, to run to black women who they think has herpes, nah. As far as beauty standards, we have the same thing. Men are not telling us to do anything. We're just listening to what we hear them say they like, and we go and act accordingly. And they do the same thing for us. That's why they get muscles and try to get a whole lot of money and cars and all that type of stuff. As far as dark skin, most homosexuals are representative of the population. And I'm talking about the women. That's anyone. Where most are brown skin, then light skin, then dark skin. Abuse, being hit or whatever the case, you could just be single. If you went to another woman, that's because that's what you wanted, just like Mr. Demery Ford said. And most black people, we know our fathers. So all those stats, that's lies as well. As far as the industries, black males, they do pursue the STEM and all these other industries, but they're not allowed in them, just like most black men are not allowed to be sports people, athletes or anything else, or rappers or anything else, because they don't want us to have money. That's what it is. As far as the dropout rate, false. Ivory Tolson, he talked about this on YouTube, and he talked about the college thing. Look it up real quick about that. Actually, it was the dropout rate and something. I don't want to take up. About that they can't read. So he addressed that. Ivory Tolson, if you just look that up on YouTube, you'll see what he has to say about that. As far as the sagging pants, I mean, most black men are not sagging their pants, and they're dressing women who are dressing like prostitutes. And the last thing I'll just say is that I hope everyone has as great a weekend as possible. And I'll mute my line. Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Gus.
As great a weekend as possible, indeed. Other folks other folks who had commentary that they wanted to get in before we wrap things up? Anybody else with a question, comment that they need to get in?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
All right. Quickly, the black men being the quote-unquote fear of white men being labeled as murderers, rapists, thought about the testimony of the Mike Brown incident of Ferguson, where the officer Darren Wilson was saying that Mike Brown was some hulking figure trying to attack him. And I see the same scenario playing out here in Chicago with the Jason Van Dyke trial. Right now they're trying to demonize Laquan McDonald, the black man who was shot by Van Dyke 16 times, into being some menacing figure who, you know, couldn't be handled unless he was shot to death. I'm reminded of that. John Burge mentioned in the book, passed away last week. Good riddance. One small step closer to eliminating white supremacy and replacing it with justice. The destroying, when she talked about the plan to destroy the black male intellectual, to me, I think it goes far beyond just miseducating black people in certain areas in large cities. But I'm reminded last year in Prince George's County, where the graduate, where it's a predominantly black population, the graduation rate is 80% and has been climbing for the last 4 or 5 years. However, last year, an investigation was thrown against the Prince George's County school system on so-called grade, I guess, grade inflating. So even in the sense of, you know, the very few successful predominantly black school systems, they are now being attacked in hopes of suppressing the black male intellectual. That's all I have for now. Meet my line.
Much obliged, Chicago, Pam's neighborhood, her geographic location. We will pause here until next Friday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, where we will resume. Again, we are slowly encroaching on the conclusion of Black Love is a Revolutionary Act. We should be following with the interracial con game. I think I said yesterday I had every intention of reading the interracial con game. I got the book courtesy of my Amazon wish list. I had it before, but I got another copy. And was reminded, wow, there are a lot of Cal's references in the book. Gus T is quoted. I wrote the book jacket review. If you have a hard copy and you turn over and look on the back, I am quoted there for my review for the text. So I feel some type of way about reading a book that I have that many quotes. I have not had to narrate a text where I would be quoting myself. That is a little peculiar, so I would prefer someone else could narrate the interracial con game whenever we get to that after we're done with this. That would be my request. If that sounds odd or like an unreasonable reason, then folks can say that as well. But there you go. With that, we'll be here tomorrow, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. Compensatory call-in, Bill Cosby. Many other things happened this week, but Bill Cosby. 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific tomorrow. Thanks to all of the folks for tuning in. I hope it was a constructive investment of your Friday evening. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white terrorism. Let's do everything that we can to minimize contact with race soldiers. Being sober would be high on that list. Take care of our brain computer so that we can get this problem solved quickly. In addition to being sober, let's be buckled up each and every time we are in our vehicle. Again, let's do everything we can to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. With that, much obliged to everyone for tuning in. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
Shut I'm a up. Victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.